Committee on Commerce, thank you very much for being here. I got a couple of announcements just to make sure everyone's in the right place. First of all, we do have overflow room in hearing room E, which is behind us and two doors down. If anyone is coming in or going and you're not able to get back into this hearing room E. On the agenda today, we have basically, looks like, five bills that are going to be considered. If you have the agenda, which the most recent one that I know of is revision number 3, it was issued on March 9th. It has two bills at the end, SB 738 and SB 931. Those bills are not, and I'll say again, are not going to be heard this afternoon. We're waiting for some amendments, and my understanding they've been rescheduled for this committee on the 22nd of this month. So if you're here for just those two bills, feel free to take off and enjoy the sunshine and tell us all about it. So then what we have before us are three groups of bills. We have the first two that we're going to take on is going to be opened up for public hearing on SB 545 and SB 634. We will probably follow that. I'm going to see how the registration's going. I know we have some people have traveled more than 100 miles, in fact, out of state. And so we may be opening up some of the other three hearings just to get their testimony if we find ourselves getting bogged down. What I'm going to ask for those who are going to be testifying today, try to, one, limit your comments to what is pertinent to the bills that are before us. If you've heard other people give that same testimony, not that you can't supplement it, but please take in consideration. We have a full room, and I'm not sure how many other people are outside that may want to be coming in for giving testimony. I want to try to give everyone the opportunity to be heard today if possible. So with that said, I'm going to go ahead and open up the public hearing, the first one, which will be for SB 545 and 634. Now, here comes the difficult part for me as the chair. I have a senator here, and I have many representatives here who all want to be first in line. Where do I start? I think I'll start with my good colleague friend who I actually was told was supposed to be the first person to speak, Senator Ryan Deckard. And then I am with the reps. I understand Representative Dingfelder is also one of the sponsors, coordinators, Representative... Okay, I was going to say Riley.
You look very hesitant.
Well, I was going to first say Merkley, then I said I should have probably said Merkley first in order since he is, you know, the Gankuba of the Democrats over there as compared to Dingfelder. But we'll get everyone up here, and then we'll have everyone else giving their testimony. So, Senator Deckard, if you want to come on up, and I'm going to go ahead and do this. Representative Merkley and Dingfelder. Okay, let's do Dingfelder, and then we'll do another two. And Representative Riley, you're also going to be testifying on this, so okay. So what we're going to do is this. We'll start you at the second panel, if that's all right, and then we'll pick up from there. And once again, I'm going to mention for those who are coming in, we do have an overflow room, hearing room E. If you're here to give testimony and you don't have a place to sit here, you can feel free to go sit down in E where it's a little bit more comfortable. You'll be able to hear us, follow us, and I will try to be working off the list and giving people heads up before they're actually going to be called up. So if you're outside of the room in another hearing room, you can work your way back to this room. With that said, Senator Deckard.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Ryan Deckard, Beaverton. I'm going to disappoint you and be very, very brief and hand it over to someone that I've met and has had an experience with payday loans that I think his story will be much more compelling than the data and the information that you're going to get. Other than I would just highlight two things that certainly came to my attention on payday loans. One is the interest rates that folks can sometimes pay can be as high as 360 to 500%. And to me, that is a rate that I think gives pause and discomfort to anyone that a citizen of the United States would be paying that type of interest, and the fact that there are more of these stores today because you and I and none of us would go to a payday lending store, but there are more of them than McDonald's, and so they have found a clientele that is at least given me great pause. Now with that, I will introduce Mr. Rick Freed, who is a recent graduate of Portland State University, in sociology and has had an experience with this industry that I feel is compelling and will be helpful to this committee as it deliberates over this bill.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Rick Fried from Portland. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm here to describe my experience with the payday loan industry. While finishing my degree at Portland State, I found myself in several instances having to dig through the couch and not finding any more change. And it became necessary to borrow money to pay bills and to buy food. My last experience was the most costly. In late December of 2004, I borrowed about $75 from a payday loan office in Portland, Oregon. I wrote them a check for $90, which would be cashed in 2 weeks, and they allowed a three-time rollover. Each rollover required a $15 cash payment to address the interest. Shortly thereafter, I was laid off, though. So while I intended to pay off before the first rollover, that obviously wasn't going to happen. I eventually found other employment, but not before I paid a total of $60 interest on a $75 loan within an eight-week period. I paid the money back with money that I borrowed from friends, so in this case, pride can be a stupid and expensive thing. I'm not here to testify to my proficiency in handling finances. Certainly, I've been both responsible and irresponsible with my money. Nor am I claiming to have experienced real poverty. While I've lived off ramen several times, and I've lived paycheck to paycheck, I've never truly experienced what many people have in terms who may have to go to these places to receive a loan. I've been lucky, and over the years I've had tremendous support from family and friends. And they're the primary reason that I've achieved my goals of finishing my degree, and one of the reasons that I'm here today. Taking these loans, though, I've often wondered how do people who have no choice or options deal with these crippling terms and choices? How do they escape 300-plus annual percentage rates when they have to borrow to provide basic necessities? I hope that my testimony today might help you ask these same questions and maybe help you walk in their shoes a little bit. And I hope that you will consider at least some reasonable changes to what seems to be predatory policies of the payday loan industry. And once again, I want to thank you for your time and allowing me to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Fried.
Thank you.
Before we take any questions, Representative Kingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jackie Dingfelder, State Representative, House District 45, Northeast Portland. And I really appreciate Senator Deckert and Mr. Fried for being here and testifying on behalf of Senate Bill 545 today. The proposal before you came out of the work of the Oregon Food Bank, which is part of the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, on which I serve as a member. And the legislative concept was part of the Act to End Hunger. This very exciting plan, which I'd urge you to read if you haven't. This is a comprehensive plan aimed at helping families become financially secure and aimed at helping them meet the nutritional needs of their family without relying on emergency food. And that's one of the aims of the Hunger Relief Task Force, is to also look at the root causes of poverty and figure out why so many Oregonians are going to food banks all over the state. As you will learn here today, payday loans are small, unsecured loans sold at a short-term fix for emergency financial needs. However, the reality is quite different for the large number of low- and middle-income working Oregonians who become trapped in a cycle of debt created by exorbitant fees and recurring loans. Cash-strapped Oregonians need access to reliable and affordable credit. So under the modest, reasonable proposal that you're going to hear more about today, payday lenders will still collect 180 annual percentage rate. Let me repeat that, 180% APR on their loans. Much more restrictive rates have been proposed in the past and by other states. The changes proposed in this bill would bring our laws in line with that of other states. Both Washington and California have a cap on fees of $15 per 100 borrowed, which translates into about 180% APR. This bill, 545, retains the allowance for the three rollovers that is currently in law. It does not touch that, and it has zero general fund impact. This is an urgent issue because, as you've already heard, the number of loans is growing each year in Oregon. You heard Senator Deckert say that there's more payday lenders in Oregon now than McDonald's, which is sort of a shocking fact when I found that out. The number of payday loans went from under 300,000 in 1999 to nearly 700,000 in 2003. And that is about 5 years. So it's been a huge increase. So you will hear lots of really good information today with much more specifics about the impact of these loans on people's lives, real Oregonians' lives who are just trying to make ends meet. And I urge you to protect vulnerable citizens from these exploitative lending practices. And I hope you will consider supporting this bill. And I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes, Senator Pachinski, just One quick point. I think we, early on in this debate, we need to establish the difference between an interest rate and a loan origination fee. And as I understand, the $15 per hundred is actually a loan fee, not an interest rate. Because if we don't separate those out, then we're going to have to, in fairness, have to address loan origination fees and late fees and so forth with credit unions and banks. So let's be specific. It's not an interest rate. It's a fee.
It is a cap on a fee. Correct. Thank you for the clarification.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Representative Merkley, Representative Ryan, and I think that's it. In the sense of, I didn't see if there's any other elected officials that have come in that have other schedule.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, it's an honor to testify today. For the record, my name is Chuck Riley. I'm a state representative for District 29 in Western Washington County. The payday loan industry bills itself as a financial crutch to prop up the struggling borrower until his next paycheck. In truth, payday loans become financial straitjackets that squeeze the working poor into perpetual debt. By design, payday loan agreements force consumers to pay high fees to renew their loans, which mount so quickly that many borrowers can never pay them off. Unfortunately, this unscrupulous business has found many thousands of customers, and every day it finds thousands more. The industry targets communities that mainstream banks ignore. When an obvious market emerges, especially in economically depressed areas where unemployment and poverty go hand in hand, the payday loan industry pounces. Check cashing outlets, payday operations, title pawn shops, rent-to-own stores, and subprime mortgage companies have infested low-income neighborhoods throughout our state and nation. My district is full of check cashing operations, title loan outfits, and payday loan offices. Many of these predatory businesses target towards the Latino community, and my district has a very large Latino community. I understand the need for short-term loans, and I don't suggest that we eliminate them, but we must protect Oregonians from legal loan sharking, Mr. Chair. It's that simple. We don't need a leading industry that charges 800%. I heard other percentages. I've heard much higher percentages in many places. We don't need these predators. I respectfully urge the members of this committee to pass Senate Bill 545 and other bills that protect the consumers of this state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Representative Jeff Merkley from House District 47 in East Portland. I'd like to be very brief. I've come to testify today because my community is ground zero, or at least it feels that way. Perhaps Representative Riley's community can compete with mine, but ground zero for payday loan lenders. I have a very high Russian population and a very high Spanish or Mexican population, both of whom, groups of which do not have highly developed relationships with traditional financial organizations. There is at least one place in my district where you can stand and see three different payday loan outlets, and several places you can see two. These organizations export out of the pockets of a relatively low-income families millions of dollars. And it is very hard, if you step back from the scene just a bit, it is very hard to imagine how this export of funds out of the pockets of poor working families can possibly be a net benefit to our society. 2 years ago, I did a survey of payday loan organizations here in Salem, and the average interest rate was 500%. Maybe that has come down to the number reported, or maybe it just varies by area in the state. But if you think about how can a family get ahead if on $1,000 in the course of a year they would have to pay $5,000 worth of interest. Now, some have argued that, well, that doesn't happen because you're only allowed three rollovers under Oregon law. But what can happen very easily is when someone reaches those three rollovers, you simply go to a new payday loan organization to pay off the first payday loan organization. So that really doesn't create a break in the cycle on the ground. So I do ask that you take this issue very seriously. The proposal put forward in the committee bill is actually a very modest approach, extending a minimum period from 2 weeks to a month. And that sort of modest approach at least would cut nearly in half the amount of funds that are exported out of low-income communities. I do think that if you look back over the centuries, virtually every society has recognized that these types of very high interest loans damage communities. And in the end, we end up picking the pieces. We pick up those pieces with more people on the Oregon Health Plan and more people on other forms of support, more broken families, and it just makes no sense. And I ask your committee to take action. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and start with another panel. I'm going to call up three individuals. If you'll please come up, that way what we're going to try to do is we'll hear your testimony. We'll then open it up for questions after all three have testified in a way of trying to keep everything flowing so we can get as many people before us. I'd like to have Patty Whitney Wise, Angela Martin, and Ellen Lowe. I think just for sake, if we'll just start on this side and we'll work across.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and committee members. I'm Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and we are supporting SB 545 because of the concerns that were raised by the Oregon Food Bank about many families who are coming in for their services. When they surveyed them to find out reasons why they were taking out the payday loans, 30% reported that they needed the loans to purchase groceries. And as we and the food bank began to look into the industry, we were frankly very shocked at how much the fees were for these very short-term loans and how easy it was for family to get deeper and deeper in debt in a very short time period. I think one of the reasons we've seen such a growth in the payday loan industry has to do with our own circumstances here in the state. Since the budget cuts of 2001 and 2003, in both of those rounds of cuts, monies were eliminated for both emergency assistance and job retention programs within the Department of Human Services. For many of these families, that's where they turned. They had gotten off of welfare, gotten a job, their car broke down. They needed the money to repair the car in order to keep their job, and so the department was able to make those one-time payments for those families. That money is virtually not there anymore, and so there is really nowhere else for these families to turn but to something like the payday loan industry. So our concern is that the rates are so exorbitant, it really makes it very difficult for these families to pay that money back without additional assistance and falling further into poverty. So we urge that you vote yes on this bill. We're one of a few states that does not regulate this industry. Most states do. You heard about our neighbors, Washington and California. We'd like to follow that example and put in some very modest protections for our lowest income families. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Angela Martin. I'm a public policy advocate with the Oregon Food Bank. My testimony today is also offered on behalf of the Oregon Food Bank Regional Food Bank Network, representing over 20 regional food banks throughout the state. As we've heard already today, and we'll hear the rest of this afternoon, the quick cash market is costing vulnerable Oregon consumers millions of dollars. Borrowers quickly become trapped in a cycle of debt as they take out a loan for triple-digit interest for a very short period of time. The reality for too many borrowers is that they're simply not able to recover from their financial crisis in the 5, 7, or 14 days that may pass before their next payday. As the numbers indicate, the loans make it very easy to get into and very difficult to get out of. Consumer protections must keep pace with the growth of the industry. Senate Bill 545 offers these modest reforms aimed at helping more consumers succeed in paying these loans off and avoiding this cycle of debt. Oregon Food Bank became interested in this issue as we began hearing more stories of the pressures families are facing through mounting debt. We undertake a biannual survey of emergency food box recipients. In our most recent survey, we found that 54% of survey respondents, and that's from 3,700 emergency food box recipients, had medical debt that they were dealing with. 39% had utility debt. The increasing debt is putting vulnerable families in a very precarious situation. They have bad credit histories, few resources to rely on, and as a result, they face an option of financing the purchase of groceries, again, at triple-digit interest rates. We urge you to take action to help protect these cash-strapped Oregonians who face the difficult choices they do when they experience those financial emergencies. You've heard the modest changes that are proposed in Senate Bill 545, so I won't go through those again. But I would like to take a minute to evoke the voice of someone who didn't join us here today. As I was doing my work connecting with people who've taken out loans, I found a lot of people who were simply too embarrassed to come up and admit publicly that they had found themselves in this situation. One such woman wrote out her testimony for me and asked me to bring it to you today. As she indicates, she is one of the many customers who have little clout in the marketplace because of her financial history. She was divorced, faced a bankruptcy after that divorce, had a good job, and 20 years experience in the financial industry. So she understood the cost of these loans, but faced few choices. Took out a payday loan, and like Rick, found that she was not able to pay the loan in full by her next payday, and started turning that loan over and over again. She's slowly working her way out, but again, it was an embarrassing situation for her and a financially devastating situation for her to be in. I think really what speaks is not just her experience financially dealing with that, but the emotional toll that it has taken on her. She wasn't willing to admit to anybody that there was a problem. And I hear that echoed throughout the conversations I've had with people. They're not willing to complain because they have a sense of pride. And I wonder if that doesn't speak to the low number of complaints that we actually see offered up to the state agencies. Folks are complaining. They're complaining to their helping agencies like Oregon Food Bank. One other point that I would like to address. I appreciate there's been a lot of confusions with the fees versus APRs. There are a lot of different terms, and how we understand that all of those terms is important. I understand that the law requires the payday loan businesses to represent the total cost of the loan, whether it's fees, whether it's interest. That must be represented as APR, giving the customers an opportunity to compare the cost of those loans. And so I think that's why so many folks talk about it in those terms. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee. I'm Ellen Lowe. I function as a legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank, for the Oregon Law Center, and Public Policy Council for United Way of the Columbia Willamette. I would like to today follow up a little bit on the process that was used in developing this bill, because if there's anything that's really grassroots, this is it. There's no astroturf in this particular proposal, because we heard from folks, whether we heard it at pantries or whether we heard it in medical clinics or in people calling the Oregon Law Center to see if there was some assistance available to them. And I would say that the groups that I represent heard it, just as Angela said, because they somehow feel that these places are non-threatening. And so they are willing to share their stories to us. They may not be willing to share it publicly. And oftentimes, those places that have an official seal are the least welcoming to many of the folks that we have been hearing from. So it was out of these discussions that the proposal developed. I'm going to be upfront with you. I think I've been criticized more by people who say this is such a modest proposal. Why didn't you go for more restrictions? But what we really wanted to do was to come forward with something that we thought was competitive with what is existing in the state of Washington and also similar to what is there in California, and that would be something that could be acceptable to you as well. Judging by some of the folks I see in the room, maybe we shouldn't have taken my advice in developing this bill. We should have asked for the moon. But because they obviously still feel threatened. But we sincerely hope that you will look very carefully at what we're seeking. You have questions about whether it's a fee or interest. In my language, I would call it the cost of doing business at a payday loan place. And what ought to be there, and we have no reason to want to put them out of business. They ought to be there for those short-term remedies, a short-term fix. What has happened, though, is that rather than some really short-term need, what we are contributing to is chronic debt. And going back to the term short-term fix, maybe for some, unfortunately, it's becoming an addiction. So we sincerely hope that you will look at this in terms of the people who need some assistance, and so that it will become part of your legislative response. And the three of us would be happy to respond to any questions. I want to say that Angela Martin has looked at laws in all 50 states. She has all the stats and is a remarkable resource for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions for the panelists? I do have a couple of questions. Ms. Martin, since you've kind of been singled out as the person with all the facts, I guess what I'd like to do is, if possible, instead of going through all this at this time, is if you have some type of log or some type of chart that maybe you've put together as to what is the what you've seen as the practice within the country, specifically probably in the western states, as to what's happening. That's one issue I'd like to know. Also like to get some testimony today as to, I know the bill calls for having a term of no less than 31 days as compared to the 14 days. I think it'd be important for myself to hear what's the importance of having that type of regulation or requirement. And the other question I had was predatory, I'm going to call it predatory practice, and I mean that, and I only say it in the sense that I'm wondering in your research if you've come across different organizations or stores that provide these services, if they have different rates in different parts of the state. Specifically, what I'd like to know is if the rates change from location to location within a given business, or if you've done any tracking to see if you see in maybe a more economically depressed area higher rates or whatever it may be compared to another, or lower rates, whatever it might be. And so I understand that's going to be maybe some stuff that you'll need to get back to us. I can tell everyone that's here today, we're not planning on moving either of these bills out today. We will be looking at everything and making some determination as to what, if anything, will move forward after today's hearing. So, Ms. Martin.
Some of those materials we can make available to you right away. The state actually compiled all of the rules that other states have in the review that they did of the payday loan industry, so can make that available to you.
Okay.
It's an interesting question that you asked about the rate change. Does it change by location? And that's something that we can look into. It's an interesting question. Why the 31 days? The purpose of this bill was, again, not to put the industry out of business, but to set the consumer up to succeed. And in having conversations with individuals of where they felt they were getting caught in this trap, it made perfect sense to me. Most people do what I do. They receive their paycheck and they pay their rent with the first paycheck, and they pay the grocery bills and the light bills and the other bills with that second paycheck. And you can't give up a large portion of any one paycheck in a month. It takes an entire month to cobble together that $75, that $100 emergency, that short-term emergency. It takes an entire month to get there. By establishing a 31-day loan period, you help that consumer get to the end of the month, put the money together to pay the loan off, versus the current experience where people have to pay that set of fees, that cost, twice because they won't succeed in that 2 weeks. You know, it's interesting. I was looking at, are there other states that went with a 31-day loan period, and stumbled across the experience that was happening in the state of Illinois, where in 2001, their Division of Financial Institutions, their state regulatory body, passed some regulations aimed at curbing payday loan practices. And in response to the regulations, which include a cap on the total amount allowed to be borrowed and some other changes, including a principal buy-down, in response to those changes, the industry shifted from their current practice of short-term 14-day, 15-day loans to 31-day loans, because that took them out of the consideration of the small loan laws in Illinois. Small loans in Illinois are described as loans of 30 days or less. So I only offer that as an example of one state where the industry went to a 31-day loan in response to some regulations they were facing.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. And regarding the material, as quick as you can get it together and deliver it either to my office or to Anna Braun, our committee administrator, that'd be beneficial.
Thank you.
I'd next like to call Reverend Dan Bryant, Pastor Dodd, as well as Corey Stressinger. And I'm going to ask Reverend Bryant and Pastor Dodd to first give their testimony, followed by Ms. Reisinger.
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to be here today. I have prepared a written testimony. I won't read all of it, but just kind of briefly summarize in the interest of time. I'm here today on behalf of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, the largest statewide ecumenical organization of its kind in the nation, and we have consistently spoken over the years to this body on behalf of the poor and the powerless, our most vulnerable citizens, and so I come here today to raise a voice of conscience and to speak to a moral principle that applies not only to this bill, 545, but also Senate Bill 968 on refund anticipation loans. And the moral principle is this: it is morally wrong to increase one's wealth by using that wealth to take advantage of the poor. It's a basic principle that runs throughout our traditions. To cite just a few examples, Exodus 22, if you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you shall not deal with them as a creditor. You shall not extract interest from them. Leviticus 25 specifically prohibits the practice of taking interest in advance or otherwise profiting from those who fall into difficulty. Exodus 18 says that oppressing the poor by taking interest in advance is no different than rape or robbery. And Nehemiah 5 tells us stories of debtors who became enslaved to their creditors, resulting in the loss of fields and freedoms. And the prophet says, I was very angry when I heard their outcry and these complaints. Now, you may have noticed there's a little debate going on in our country right now around the certain display of the Ten Commandments in our halls of judicial process. I think it is absolutely incomprehensible and morally indefensible that we as a society can pride ourselves on our public display of the religious foundations to our legal system, while behind the scenes we ignore everything else that tradition teaches about protecting the poor. And I'm not advocating that our laws governing the financial industry be dictated by any religious tradition. Rather, I am calling to your attention the critique of the predominant religious tradition of this country upon the abuse of wealth and power to guide your own sense of what is fair and just for the economically disadvantaged. Speaker Minnis spoke to the Interfaith Advocacy Day a couple of weeks ago when we were here in Salem, and she told us that the legislators of this body are compassionate people. And so I simply want to appeal to your compassion today. I won't cite all the statistics, many of which you have already heard, and which are there in my written testimony. I would point out one thing I've not yet heard, and that is the particularly insidious situation we create by sanctioning gambling in our state, and the those who have gambling debts who use payday loans in order to pay off those debts, creating a double bind that is especially problematic. We believe that the reforms called for in Senate Bill 545 are perfectly fair, reasonable, and just. They allow the payday loan industry to continue to do business and to make a considerable profit while protecting the interest of consumers from predatory practices that take advantage of those in desperate need or who otherwise lack access to more conventional lending resources and who may also lack financial sophistication to fully comprehend the true cost of the loan. I can personally attest to this from one of my parishioners who told me that he was charged 10% for a check of $330 when I asked him how much that 10% was. He, in a straight face, replied to me, $10. He could not compute what 10% meant. We call upon you to do what is morally right. Hear the cry of those who have become saddled with unreasonable debts. We are not asking you to become angry like the prophet Nehemiah. We only ask that you do the right thing for the sake of our most vulnerable citizens. Please support 545.
Thank you.
Dear Chair Prosansky, members of the committee, I'm Tom Dodd. I'm pastor at United Lutheran Church in Eugene. I'll never forget the eye-opening experience for me, which happened on June the 27th, 1999, when a member of my congregation called me telling me that she was in trouble financially. She was living on SSI, usually was able to get by, but she had run into a rough patch. And so she had taken out two payday loans. She was not able to pay them back entirely, and so she rolled them over and rolled them over again. And she just was not able to get out. So she called me up
asked for help. I really could not believe what she was telling me, so I asked if I could come over to her apartment and look at her paperwork. She said yes, and so I came over, and I was astounded to see what she had agreed to, and I computed the fee cost, and one was for 234%, the other on an annual basis, the other one was for 729% on an annual basis. It just fully surprised me. And so what I did to help her was, thankfully, through the generosity of the people in my congregation, I have a discretionary fund. And so I paid off both those loans for her. For one loan, I was able to give that to her as a gift. The other loan, what I did was, I asked her to agree to pay the loan back to the church at no interest. And also, as part of that process, to go to a money management class. I'm glad that she agreed to do that. And since then, she, one, paid off the loan, two, went to the class, and three, has never been able or has not come back to the church for that kind of assistance. For me, that was an eye-opening experience. Not everybody has a congregation that can help them out that way. Thousands of other people get involved in such loans and don't find a way out. I called around myself to payday loan companies in Eugene in 1999. I found rates of equivalent to 546%, 445%, and that 729% annual percentage rate. So last week, I decided to update my figures, and I called around to companies in the Eugene Springfield area. There I found rates of 390%, again, on an annual basis, 400%, 468%, 520%, and 546%. Thankfully, the one that was 729 lowered their rates. It's only a little over 500%. Thank God for small favors. Now, some changes have already been made since 1999, and I am glad for that. Restricting the number of times to be able to roll over, that sort of thing. I'm glad for Senate Bill 545, which limits interest to 180% on an annualized basis, the repayment of, in a 30-day period. Because when you change that, when you double the period, you effectively cut it, the fee rate in half. So I'm glad for that. Now, I'm also aware that people have made comments that regulation is not necessary because these loans are made out, are taken out by adults. They know what they're getting into, and they should have the responsibility to take care of that. To this, I have a couple of responses. The first is that if that line of reasoning were consistently followed, we would have no banking regulations whatsoever. We would also not have protections for safe drugs or food or working conditions. Indeed, each individual would need to do the best that he or she could in dealing with those who had more money, more power, but oftentimes less conscience. In the face of this, we as a society need to regulate the power of certain groups for the good of society as a whole and for the weaker members in particular. And I looked over and I saw that he was going to quote the Bible. I was glad that my quotes weren't the same as his quotes. Proverbs 31:8-9. King Lemuel is taught by his mother. Speak out for those who cannot speak, for the rights of all the destitute. Speak out, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. In Isaiah 1:17, directions given to the marginalized of society. Learn to do good, seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. Finally, Proverbs 22:22-23. Do not rob the poor because they are poor, or crush the afflicted at the gate, for the Lord pleads their cause. Thank you for receiving this testimony and your work to do justice, especially for the weaker among us.
There's a lot to quote from.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Floyd Lanter, the administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, is with me in the audience, and if we have questions that he needs to come up and help answer, I may ask him to do that.
Would you like Mr. Landers to come up with you now?
That may be helpful if we could.
If you don't mind. If we have any questions here up here, we'll bring you back up.
I have provided written testimony. I regret that I do not have Bible quotes, and I feel like I was in good company in this panel. I feel privileged to have shared the podium with them. We have provided you with some information in the written testimony, which I won't go through in detail, as other witnesses have testified to some of it, but there were a couple of things I wanted to mention. We do license and regulate payday lending today, and last spring we did a fairly extensive review of the industry, including an informal survey of users of payday lending, to gather information about what their experiences were. As I think you've heard mentioned, we don't get a lot of formal complaints. These practices are legal in most cases, so there aren't steps that we could necessarily take. And as I think you heard, we also do believe that a number of people are embarrassed that they need to use payday lending. But we did feel that it would be useful to specifically go ask them on an anonymous survey basis what their experiences had been. One of the attachments to the testimony is the open-ended responses to the open-ended questions. And it gives an interesting flavor and somewhat a consistent flavor. Many of the respondents said things like, I'm grateful that this industry exists. I need them. But the interest is high. The interest is high, but it's better than nothing. If you have no other options, what can you do? I wish I had not had to use their services, but I can't get a loan any other way. A number of comments that it's very quick and it's very easy. The people are polite, but again, it's easy to get in over your head. And a number of people commented on it being a vicious cycle, that when you take advantage of this service, it is important to have, it's important to be able to use, but it's very hard to get out of. You asked about what other states do in this area, and one of the attachments to the testimony is a chart comparing Oregon's current regulation with that in other states. Senate Bill 545 would bring Oregon in line with many other states in a couple of areas. One of them is the charges. Many states do impose restrictions on the charges for these loans that are similar to the $15 per hundred for the first initial term, $10 per hundred for rollover terms. Those are in line with what other states do. In addition, for those, many states do not, by the way, allow rollover or extension terms. In those states that do, it is common to have an amortization feature. That is a feature that says if you want to roll it over, part of it has to be paid down first so that you don't get into that cycle of escalating debt. In fact, the debt decreases. And Senate Bill 545 would include that feature. It would require 25% of the debt to be paid off to roll it over. Again, those states that allow rollovers frequently do have some type of amortization provision. The feature that would be unique in 545 that we have not seen in other states is the 31-day minimum term. Most other states that have minimums, they are quite a bit shorter, 7 days or 14 days. And we are not clear on what implications that would have for the industry, because it would be a significant change in the current business practice, which often does focus on those shorter-term loans. As I think you've heard, this industry has expanded significantly. We think at least with respect to the fee caps and the amortization feature, those are fairly consistent with what many in the industry do today, or at least the fee cap is, and they would put Oregon in line with other states. I would like to briefly mention, in addition to our regulation and licensing of this industry, those comments about it's the only option I had really made us think about how do we help people understand what options are available and maybe even expand the options that are available. We did encourage Oregon's credit unions to offer alternatives to payday lending. A number of them have done so, and I think you're going to hear from the credit union industry. We also worked with the payday lending industry to develop an informational brochure, which you will see attached to the testimony, which advises consumers on the features of these loans, on alternatives they might want to consider. consider, on things to think about in making a financial decision. And that brochure is now, as of 2005, being distributed to customers of payday loans. I do want to briefly touch on Senate Bill 634, which has not been mentioned by other witnesses today, and that is a bill that is was introduced at our request by a member of this body. And we view it, although those in the industry may not, as more of a technical bill intended to confirm the rulemaking authority of the Department of Consumer and Business Services over payday lending. We don't view it as grounds to change what we regulate. We have no intent to expand our current regulation. But the history here is that the regulation of payday lending was put into statute in 2003. And as part of that bill, we requested specific rulemaking authority specific to payday lending. And the industry's position that was expressed in testimony was that that was unnecessary because the department already had general rulemaking authority under Chapter 725 and that this additional rulemaking authority would be duplicative. And in fact, if you look at the legislative staff analysis, which we did attach to our testimony, that the rulemaking authority was taken out of the bill, and the legislative staff explanation is that the committee amendment removes duplicative authorization for DCBS to adopt rules regulating payday loans. So our rules are currently in effect, and we were somewhat surprised to receive from one participant in the industry a legal opinion during this past interim saying that, in fact, they believed we did not have the legal authority to enforce the rules that we have, that our rules exceeded our statutory authority. That's a grave concern to us, and specifically in the area of good faith. Currently, what our rules say is that a lender must have a good faith belief that the borrower has an ability to repay. In Oregon, we don't have a cap on the amount of the loan. Many states do, but we do not in Oregon. But our rules do say that the lender must have a good faith belief that the borrower can repay. We have a safe harbor provision in our rule that says that if the loan amount isn't more than 25% of the borrower's income, they can presume that the borrower has the ability to repay. But if they want a loan more than 25%, and most of the industry, by the way, sticks with that 25% guideline, if a lender wants to advance more than 25%, they have to, based on objective factors, and they have to find and document that there is that ability to repay. We think that's an important rule. We think it works well for the industry. It's not our intent to expand it, but we also don't want to get into a lawsuit about it. For that reason, we do ask your support for Senate Bill 634 to confirm our authority to enforce that rule. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Sure. Senator.
There's several questions.
Go right ahead.
These witnesses will have another shot at them at another hearing. Is that true?
Maybe not. I mean, the intent of the chair at this point is to take as much testimony as we can. Then I think
I didn't want to spend a lot of time talking with these two because I'm sure there's other people that want to testify, okay. But I do have a number of questions.
All right, so let me just go through and we'll figure out if this is the best time to do it. My goal at this point is to take as much testimony as we can today. I expect that I will ask for a work group to be put together to kind of get our arms and hands around what we're dealing with and what, if anything, we might want to consider doing through that process. That might be a place where some of these questions could be answered. And when you say a number of questions, Senator, just give me a ballpark of what you're looking at.
Half a dozen anyway, but there's a couple that I do want to ask.
Yeah, and I said, let's go ahead and ask them. We'll see how we're going. Actually, we're doing pretty good on time. Everyone's being very cooperative, so let's go ahead and get some of the stuff on the record so that might generate some more dialogue.
Mr. Chair, particularly with regard to Senate Bill 634, do you require of credit card companies good faith indication that the payee is able to pay?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, credit card companies generally are not subject to our regulation. They are nationally regulated.
The answer is no. Okay. I mean, it seems a little strange that we would generally that provision of the good faith ability to pay is not extended to unsecured loans, and this would be kind of breaking new ground because certainly that isn't a feature of any credit card contract that I've ever seen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, you're correct. That's not part of the standard federal regulation for credit card companies. Although these loans are unsecured, as you point out, they're generally a postdated check is generally given. So in that sense, the lender has the right to draw directly from the borrower's bank account rather than wait for a payment to be made.
There's another question. There's another couple of features, I believe, of 535 that you haven't really brought out. One of those is in Section 3, a lender in the business of making payday loans may not shift down to 9, charge a consumer fee other than interest described in this section and the fee described in subsection 3, which is a dishonored check. So that would limit there would be no other fee that they could charge except for the dishonored check fee. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, other than the $15 per hundred for the initial term and the $10 per hundred for the rollover term.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Okay. Do you know of any other loaning industry regulations that require the loaner to, once the payback has been violated and they only get 25%, then they'd better be required to reduce the interest rate or the fees charged by a third to, in order to redo it? I mean, that seems a strange reward for someone who's unable to pay or unable to fulfill their contract.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, no. Generally, we do not regulate interest rates for most types of financial industries in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Chair Przanski, for the record, Floyd Lanter, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Securities. Senator Whitsitt, in response to your question, you're correct. Most lenders are eligible to charge a default rate once a loan goes into default. The thought in the payday lending industry is that they are charging a high enough fee or rate at the front end to compensate for their risk. Therefore, the rules do not allow for further charges once it goes into default or passes a third rollover.
Could you just kind of describe the information that is required, currently required by payday lenders to make available to their clientele before they sign a payday loan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the only information which we currently require them to make available, and not hand but simply have available, is the brochure, which we attach to the testimony. Now, they do have federal disclosure requirements under the Truth in Lending Act, so they are required to make the same disclosures that any lender must make.
Just briefly, what information is mandated to be in that brochure?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the brochure was drafted by our department, and it is general consumer information, we in the industry actually drafted it together. That is, the industry participated in reviewing it, as well as other stakeholders, and it looks like this.
Mm-hmm. So does that have an APR in it and all that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the APR information is also required under federal law to be disclosed. It's not contained in this consumer brochure.
You know, is there any indication, do you have any requirements of any other posters or anything that these companies are to prominently display for their clientele to see?
Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, that's correct. They are actually required to post at the place where they're extending the credit, the annual percentage rate posted conspicuously. So that it should be on the wall or made, you know, a counter poster. So for a typical loan.
And would those same disclosures be on any loan that the recipient signed?
Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, in the actual loan documents that they signed, yes, there are requirements that the terms of the loan be of a certain font. Certain emphasis required, so that's there in the loan documents, as is for the requirement for most other lending industries.
Mm-hmm. Approximately, how many of these loans are issued annually in Oregon? Let's say in 2004, do you have a rough idea of that?
The Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, the most recent data I have available for me is 2003. There were 677,000 payday loans made in Oregon. Mm-hmm. With a dollar amount of $214,629,000.
Do you have some sense of how many written, how many verifiable complaints your department received?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Whitsitt, we get very few complaints. I do have numbers, but as I was talking with Director Streisinger this morning, the important thing is the context behind those numbers. And as you've heard testimony earlier here, many people don't like to complain to us.
I appreciate that testimony, but I would like to know how many complaints you've received.
Yes, Chair Pozanski, Senator Whitsitt, we received 16 complaints in last year on payday lending, and that's up considerably. We had none in 2003 and less than 10 in the previous 4 years.
So, just quickly, that'd be about 1 per 70,000 loans.
Okay. Any other questions?
Not right now.
Okay.
Thank you.
I got a couple of questions I'd like to. On the status of that business that sent the letter saying that they are now potentially challenging the authority of the rulemaking, what is the status on that?
Mr. Chair, they have not made a challenge. They met with us and gave us the legal opinion.
When did that occur?
I believe it was in the fall, but I cannot recall specifically. We'd be happy to provide you with a copy of it if you'd like to see it.
I'd like to see that, please. And the other thing I'd like to find out is this...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, September
2004. And basically what I understand is that they sent the letter with whatever sites they had as to maybe the limitation that's, that the agency may be facing, and there's been no other action at this point.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And regarding this payday loans in Oregon that you are requiring to be submitted to a person that is... seeking this type of loan, when did this come into effect? When did this become a requirement to be handed out?
Mr. Chair, I believe it was January of this year.
Chair Pozanski, it is not a requirement. It's just to be made available at the place where loans are made. There's no statutory or regulatory requirement. It was a collaborative effort with the industry and the division as a result of our policy or program review of this area in earlier 2004.
Do you know if there's any regulation or requirement for any of these any of these companies within this industry to post or give information to their clients as to where they could file a complaint if they should choose to do so?
Chair Pozanski, the license that is issued to these lenders has a toll-free number with the rings in the division, and that is to be posted in the place of lending.
Okay.
In addition, Mr. Chair, they are advised by this brochure that they may contact us with complaints or questions.
And that's since January?
Since January, yes.
And then so, I guess the last question I have at this point is, has your office looked at any of the rates that are charged between locations of a particular lending institution between geographically within the state?
Mr. Chair, our examiners have not seen any evidence that an individual licensee, that is a company, charges differential rates based on location.
Okay. And, Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Sorry I missed the first part of your testimony. The written testimony says that there are annual percentage rates, APRs, that can often exceed 400% to 500%. What's the highest APR you've seen?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Ringo, I would just be speculating. I would have to add the examiners track this information as they go in on exams, and we do. I have two full-time examiners, and they spend their lives on the road examining these locations. I can get you that information because it can actually vary. We actually have businesses that will use a payday lender to meet payroll needs, for example. So some can get up there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I was focused on the rate. It says exceed 400% to 500%. Have you seen them as high as 700 or 800% APR?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Ringo, no. My experience is that they range from 390%, which is $15 per 100, to around 500%, which is $20 per 100. And understand that most consumers look at the fee, even though the lenders are required to disclose the cost as an annual percentage rate. They look at the fee for the most part.
I see. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And how does the APR that's charged correlate with the risk of the loan? I mean, they've got the check. Is there a history of
payday loans being defaulted on? And
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Ringo, based on the information that I've seen, and keep in mind we don't get a lot of operating information from these folks, so my testimony here today is based on publicly held payday lending firms, and the loss ratios typically run 20% of gross revenues. That's how the industry looks at it. My experience is in the regulatory world is from the banking world, and we typically measure losses as a percentage of total loans. In that case, these lenders typically lose 2 to 4% of loans extended. That rate is less than what a credit card bank loses.
Okay, so I just want to be so their loss rate is less than a credit card, yet the interest that they're charging is 10, 20, 30 times what a credit card would charge.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Ringo, yes, I would agree. Okay.
And do you see any justification why they need to charge an interest rate that high given the relatively low risk of the loan?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Ringo, that's kind of a loaded question, but keep in mind that when folks go to a payday lender, they are essentially writing an NSF check or a non-sufficient funds check to start with, so there is a considerable risk there.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, it is also useful to remember that each of these loans is a separate transaction that does have transaction costs associated with setting it up. So although the loan amounts are small, there is some processing work involved for the entity in setting it up.
Okay, just one more, Mr. Chair.
One more.
I'm just trying to understand that, in general, I think in the lending world there's a correlation between the interest rate that's going to be charged and the risk. And I guess I'd like your opinion as to whether the risk that the lender is taking in this case warrants an interest rate of 400 to 500% APR.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, it's a value judgment. We do support the caps in this bill. We did provide, as one of the exhibits to the testimony, a comparison chart showing typical payday lending, how the fees work and how the money flows today versus under this bill. Some of the prior witnesses testified about the moral issues. We're regulators, so I can't express a viewpoint on that.
Thank you very much.
Senator Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you may have answered this question or spoken to it already. I apologize for being out of the room. But you mentioned that the customer or the consumer is already, in a sense, writing an NFS check. And what would the typical bank fee for that check be if it's an NFS check?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Beyer. Again, those fees are not regulated in the financial industry, and most banks charge anywhere from $20 to $30 per item. And depending on how they process the items in an account, a consumer could conceivably incur more cost by overdrawing or running an NSF check through their bank account. And I think it's fair to say that most consumers do make economic decisions, so they are looking at the cost of an NSF check or charge versus the cost of a payday loan when they decide to use a payday lender.
Thank you. One more question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Are any what we may call traditional financial institutions doing payday type loans?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Beyer, yes, I'm proud to say that the credit union industry in Oregon has stepped up, and we involved a number of key stakeholders when we did the program review in early 2004, and one of the things we pointed out was that the credit union industry and the banks, for that matter, stopped extending short-term type credit over the years due to deregulation and a number of other things such as profitability. But the credit union industry responded quite well to the comments that we advanced, and I think you'll hear some testimony later today about that.
We do have one person that signed up for the credit union, so give us that perspective. I do have one other question. In your working with the institution, or the industry, I should say, was there any discussion as to what was going to be posted in the sense of what it would cost for these loans or these type of transactions besides using APR. Was there any discussion about having what the fixed dollar amount would be, knowing my limitations as to when it comes to higher math? I'm just wondering if there was any discussion as to trying to make it, let's say, as plain and as basic as for those who come in that may not be as versed in the financial world.
Chair Przanski, a good question, and yes. In the brochure, that was discussed at length. As I pointed out earlier, that most consumers will actually look at the cost based on the fee, not the annual percentage rate. And, you know, can they afford it or do they want to entertain that cost to take a loan? So, yes.
Okay. I do have a question.
Okay.
When you're ready.
You can just go ahead and do it.
Chair Przanski, yeah. Mr. Lettner, just to follow up on the query that Senator Ringo was asking you, on the loss per, you said they have about a 20% loss and on an annualized rate of 2 to 4%, but I'm a little confused there because these payday loan lenders have, assuming a two-week span of an average span of loans, they have the opportunity to roll that money over 26 times in a year. And so I'm having trouble getting around a 20% default and only showing up as 2 to 4% per year when you roll it over 26 times. I'm having trouble with that math.
Chair Przanski, Senator Whitfitt, good question. Keep in mind that these lenders are revenue-driven. So, like I say, in the industry, they typically calculate their loss or risk based on the revenue that they're generating. We do track, in the division, we get an annual report, the number and the amount of loans that they extend. And that's what I'm basing my earlier comments on. I can take the number of loans that they extended during the year and the amount of loans that they actually charged off and calculate that ratio. I do not get information on revenue flows, only from publicly traded companies, so I can't speculate as to that. But from the publicly traded companies' information, it's been around 20% of revenue. Based on the raw numbers that I receive, it runs 2 to 4% of loans extended during the year. And I related that to the experience of a typical credit card bank, which runs 4, 5, 6, 7% over the last 4 or 5 years.
Thank you.
All right. If there's no other questions for this panel, I'm going to ask y'all to please step back. And I do want to ask the senators, we had two other people that we asked to step back to allow for this panel, Reverend Bryant and Pastor Dodd. Were there any questions that we needed to direct to them? All right. Thank you very much. What I'm going to do now is I want to bring in, a different perspective. I have four people that are currently signed up who wanted to speak in against the bill. I know there are others who want to speak in favor. We will come back. I just want to mix it just a little bit. So I'm going to go ahead and ask this time Mike Dewey, John Powell, Lou Ann Stoltz, and Annette Price, I believe.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. What I have submitted
First, just for the record, everyone needs to be identifying themselves so we can make sure it's on the tape, or I get in trouble.
So do I. My name is Annette Price. I represent the Community Financial Services Association of Oregon, and again, we welcome the opportunity to testify before the committee today. I've provided committee staff with testimony that Lou Ann Stoltz will be presenting, and also postcards, which both committee staff has received in their offices upstairs, but these are additional postcards from clients, customers of the community financial services industry in against Senate Bill 545 and Senate Bill
34. And also, Chair Przanski, to your question about proprietary or specific targeting of locations or charging more for particular customers, I've also provided for you a letter from Tom Shuckless, who is the president of the Community Financial Services Association. In summary, we're not aware of any activity such as that by members of our association. And with that, I'd like to introduce to present testimony Luann Stoltz. Luann is the chair of our Government Relations Committee for the Community Financial Services Association of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Luann Stoltz, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. I own Any Day's Payday, which is a payday loan store in Portland, Oregon. I actually have two stores, and I'm here as a small business owner today and as the Government Relations Chair for the Community Financial Services of Oregon. We represent 124 stores throughout Oregon, and we are opposed to Senate Bill 545. I'm a retired school teacher. I taught at Aloha High School in Beaverton, Oregon, and we have a family history of financial services in my family. My father opened one of the first payday loan stores in the state of Washington about 15 years ago. My sister has three payday loan stores in Vancouver, Washington, and I have two stores in Portland. My two adult children work for me in my stores, and I employ five other people as well. We pride ourselves on our customer service, and we fully appreciate our customers, and we know that they are the lifeblood of our business. We never wittingly abuse our customers. We try and work with them when they are struggling financially. We'll waive their NSF fees. We work out payment programs that can allow them to pay off their loans. And our customers frequently tell us that they appreciate the customer service that we provide to them. And they often mention that they wish banks would provide them with the same courtesy. The fact that the Department of Consumer and Business Services has had so few complaints, I think, speaks to how happy our customers are with our services. Finally, I want you to realize that I am here to speak to you for my customers, and they have said in a number of times, other people have said that they are shy to come and speak, and I think that that is true. Many of my customers are working today so that they couldn't come and speak to you, but they sent you postcards to let you know their opinion on payday loans in Oregon, and I hope that you will be able to appreciate their positions.
Thank you. Just for the record, my understanding from speaking with Ms. Braun, we've received something like in the neighborhood of 945 to 950 postcards so far. So thank you for that testimony. Mr. Dewey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mike Dewey. I represent the Consumer Lending Alliance. My client operates in 22 states. It does not operate in Washington. It does operate in California. And it has approximately 2,000 employees across the United States. With regard to some of the questions I asked my client about the demographics and if you charge a higher rate to certain individuals in certain areas, and the answer is no. My client does tell me, though, if somebody comes to them and says, I can get a rate or a fee of X, are you willing to meet that? In many cases, they are. So the market is competitive. I'm a free market believer. I think what we need to talk about a little bit is to be sure that we understand the rules, and this is a copy of the rules that pertain to both payday loans and title loans. And they are licensed. They are examined. For example, all of their advertising has to stay in the file so that the examiner can look at their advertising and see what they're doing. As you know, they have to prominently display what the APR is. I mean, and we get into trouble here talking about the fee and the APR, but it does say the APR. We have to prominently display in that location if there is a concern that they have, an inquiry, a complaint, what that number is, and it's in the brochure, and I think that's a wonderful thing that happens. My client tells me if you've got an area that is primarily a minority area, they want to have somebody, if it's Hispanic, that speaks Spanish, because that really makes sense. There's a comfort level when you have that kind of cooperation. As you heard, there are very, very few complaints. One of the things I did want to talk about is the time value of money here, and I can give you some examples. And Representative Senator Beyer talked about this to a degree. But there are individuals that recognize that they're in a difficult situation. They don't want to bounce a check. They have a payday, and they have a job. We know when they're going to get paid. But we talked about a fee of $30 on $200 on a payday loan, and that's 391%. If you rent an apartment and it's $500 and you have a $50 late fee, and that's after 5 days, that's 520%. A $200 credit balance and you're 1 day late, and it's $29 for that 1 day, and I've been there before, unfortunately, that's 5,292%. And if you bounce a check and it's $25 on one side and $20 on the other, a $200 bounce check, that's 585%. So you can see that individuals look at this from the standpoint of what is the best strategy in many, many cases. And they don't want to bounce those checks, and so oftentimes they need to come to a payday lender. Also, I wanted to provide with you, this is a copy I went online last night, to see what you could do in terms of getting loans online. And it's not very difficult. So I suggest that there are, if you change the interest rate, you change the 31 days, whatever the case may be, I suggest to you that individuals are pretty savvy and they can find other ways to get loans. One of the things I wanted to talk about, and it's, I think, relevant, but it, to a degree, is a little bit different. My client, a few years back, did a survey of the individuals that borrow from them. And this was a nationwide survey, and it was an independent company that did that. And I can provide that to you, but let me highlight a few of the categories. The highest percentage of individuals that borrowed were in the 35 to 44 age. So it was not the older people or younger people. This surprised me. The highest category percentage-wise, albeit it wasn't by a whole bunch, income-wise was $50,000 to $74,000. And that surprised me, and I'm sure it did my client. And another factor, very interesting, is that 77% did not have credit cards. So it told me that they didn't handle credit very well. And that was one of the reasons that they were unfortunately coming to a payday loan. One of your former colleagues on a radio talk show said to the individual that was interviewing him, said, well, you know, the individual on the radio said, well, you know, they don't have any other choice. He said, they can go to the ATM. Well, they can't go to the ATM because they don't have a credit card. I think it is a wonderful thing that the credit unions are stepping in. If they can provide a lower fee, I think that makes a lot of sense, and people should take advantage of that if they can. There are a lot of reasons that they don't, obviously. Last but not least, I want to say with regard to locations, and some legislators talked about location. As you know, in real estate, if you're going to be successful, it is location, location, location. That's just a fact of life. So if you're not going to be in Beverly Hills, probably. You might have a few more in a certain section of Portland, but that's because there is a market. We have met with the food bank, and some of the things that we talked about is working with these individuals, as this lady does. We talked about working with the credit counseling people, and we think that makes sense. We may disagree in terms of this piece of legislation, but there are things we can do that are very positive out there. So with that, I will finish, and if you have any questions after Mr. Pell, I'd be happy to answer those. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Powell. Before you, representing Cottonwood Financial. They do business in Oregon as a cash store. Mr. Chairman, I will not take the committee's time since you mentioned a work group on these. Jim Gardner and I represent Cottonwood, and I'll volunteer him for the work group. I just say, Mr. Chairman, when I was a kid, there was a different payday mechanism in our society. My parents charged their groceries. I used to go in and pick them up and sign a little slip. We charged our gas, and on payday, we paid those bills. Unfortunately, that small town life doesn't exist anymore. There's no gas station in Halsey. The grocery store can't afford to loan money or give credit. So it is a different world. I think the need for this kind of lending has been established, and I think the regulator believes that, and I think the people in the room today understand that. Some of the provisions in the bill before us would, in fact, be problematic both for the consumer and for the lender. The 31-day loan period, I think, would increase defaults. One thing certain about a payday loan is you have to have a job, you have to have a checking account, and you have to have a pay stub. If you lengthen the time to pay back the loan, then it is more problematic, I think, to the consumer, who would have more opportunities to spend the money elsewhere, as opposed to having it come due basically on their payday. So, Mr. Chairman, we look forward to working with you on this.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. My understanding is that other states have caps on payday loans. Is that consistent with your understanding?
Any of us?
Any of you?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ringo, there are states that do have caps.
My understanding is almost all states have caps. Oregon is one of the few states that does not have a cap. And I assume that the payday lending business flourishes in those other states. What, is there any reason to think that if we had some sort of caps in Oregon, it still wouldn't flourish here?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ringo, I'm not privy to the financial implications, but nonetheless, as I mentioned, we do not do business in Washington, and they have caps, certain procedures, and so forth, and I think that's one of the reasons we don't think we could do very well in that state.
Well, just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. I mean, I'm looking at this testimony from Luann Stoltz. Is that you? I'm sorry.
That's me.
I mean, your sister has three stores in Vancouver, right?
Yes, Senator.
Is she making a decent living doing that?
So far.
Okay. So caps. Washington has caps?
Yes, Washington does have limits on their fees.
Okay. I just haven't heard an explanation why other states seem to live okay under caps, but in Oregon it would be such a disaster.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I think there are lenders who do not do as high a volume that it would be problematic to.
I see. One more, Mr. Chair?
One more.
Thank you. I mean, there used to be in Oregon usury laws, and I think that included in the concept of usury was the idea that the concept of interest rates is kind of confusing, and you know, it's hard to that's why the federal government has lots of restrictions on lending, and we have the APR calculation so people can compare apples to apples on that. And I mean, just given the complexity of interest rates, that isn't this something where the consumer does deserve some protection? You're essentially throwing the consumer out to a buyer beware world of, you know, if you get screwed in a 2,000% interest rate, that's your problem. And I'm just suggesting that there ought to be a place here for protecting the consumer, because it's so complicated.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ringo, I would agree we always want to look for ways to protect the consumer. I think in many ways, and I'm not sure if you were in the room, I talked about the rules. And one, they provide substantial protections with regard to the rules. The brochure, I think, is a good thing. I think the dilemma here with the interest rate is these don't go out for a year,
yeah.
And that's what people think about. So there may be another way to do this. It may be in terms of disclosure that you also disclose and let them know in very bold print what the fee is. And I think people can totally understand that, as opposed to what does 390% mean or 200%. Because I really don't know what that means in dollars, unless you did you had the calculator to figure that out. So, I mean, we don't disagree that there might be another way to do it. I will tell you, though, with regard to setting caps, the question is, where do you start? We are opposed to where this particular bill is in terms of setting the cap.
Well, I agree. You got to pick a line, and it becomes arbitrary. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Can I just say one thing?
You may.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ringo, I believe if you compare this lending to any other form of lending, the disclosure would be clearer with these loans than any other loan you could go get. Bar none.
Can I just fault one more, Mr. Chair?
Everyone wants just one more. I wish I got a dime for every one more. Go ahead. I've got.
Well,
a couple
I just wasn't asked Mr. Powell. I mean, going back to questions. if other states operate fine under caps, why can't Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I believe that a certain number of high volume lenders would operate under certain cap levels in Oregon, but the industry as a whole, I don't think, would operate.
Sounds like a guess to me, but thank you very much.
All right, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a question for Mr. Dewey. You mentioned a few other annualized rates there of different fees and things charged, but you didn't mention one that I think ties into your testimony where you said people can go to an ATM. Many of these ATMs charge $1.50, $2, $2.50 fee for a $20 or $40 withdrawal. Did you calculate the interest rate on that, by any chance, on an annualized basis?
I didn't do, Mr. Chair and Senator Barr, I didn't do that. We can calculate that. Obviously, and I've done that before, and I take as much money out as I really want to, because I don't want to feel as though I got you know what. But I would say that it just seems to me that if you've got this many entities operating in Oregon, and it seems to me that if you're going to, you need to do volume, you're going to try and be competitive in the marketplace. And if there's a store across the street and you're advertising, it seems to me that if you're efficient, now you've got to be efficient, that you're going to have a lower fee or APR, whatever the case may be, to bring more people into your store. That's intuitive to me, and that's what happens in the real marketplace. So that's why we would be opposed to setting arbitrary limitations.
Another question?
Sure.
I didn't ask for just one more.
I thought you did.
Okay. That was my first.
Oh, okay.
This question is to Lance Stoltz. You've been in business by your written testimony about 2 years, and could you just tell me, walk me through a typical transaction, what happens, how, just kind of describe your business.
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, I've been in business for 5 years.
Oh, okay.
Since 1999.
That's okay. She looks young.
I'm proud of that. Typically, if you were going to be a customer of mine, the first time that you came in to see me, you would bring in your pay stub and your picture ID, a copy of your bank statement, and you'd fill out an application that gave your basic information, where you live and your phone number and that kind of thing. And then we would look at your pay stub, and we would, based on what your take-home pay is, loan you someplace between 10 and 25% of your take-home pay. And let's say that came out to be $100 for you. I would hope it'd be more.
He is a legislator.
Yeah, legislator, it's $5.
Oh, I read that article. I think it's $50. Sorry.
We have limits.
So you would write me a postdated check for $115. That's the rate that I charge at my store. Different stores set their own rates. Dated to your next payday. We would have a promissory note that would explain all of the legal implications of the loan that you would sign. I'd give you a copy of the promissory note. I give you $100 in cash. And then on your payday, you have the choice of having me deposit your check, or you can bring the $115 in cash to me, and I return your check to you. Or if you need to extend the loan, you would pay the $15 and keep that $100 for another 2 weeks. You can do an extension three times, and then you have to pay it off for one day.
Okay. I guess just one more kind of a, this is the last one. And I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this, but the other typical short-term loan we hear about, or we've heard about this building, is a title loan, a car title loan, where when you have a car title, you take it to a title loan store and you give them the title to get your money. In this case, if you were limited to three rollovers, or if you couldn't charge more than 25%, and the person wanted more than 25% of payroll, would there be anything that would prevent that person, when they walked into your store, walked out with their 25% of payroll, to go across the street to Mr. Dewey's store and get whatever additional money?
I charge a lot less.
No, currently there are no strict regulations for that. We do ask our customers if they have other payday loans, and so we trust for them to tell us the truth. And it's not to my advantage to loan to somebody who has loans at other stores, because I've given them cash.
But it would be to your advantage to loan them 26% if that's what they need, rather than have them go across the street to get another loan and pay a higher fee.
That may be true.
Great. Mr. Chairman, could I ask a question on behalf of three people in the audience? I have three people here on the two insurance bills.
We're going to hear testimony.
Okay.
Does that help?
That helps.
Okay.
Thank you.
The other question I guess I had, Ms. Stoltz, this may be for you or maybe Ms. Price. I'm wondering if you could tell us or if you could get us any information regarding, like, Vancouver, since it's a bordering city to the state, how much business is going across from Oregon into Washington? My theory there is, if people know that they have less of a fee and the caps, etc., in Washington State, do we actually see people driving across the state lines to transact this type of business? Or are they eligible to do so?
Mr. Chair, speaking with my sister, I believe that some Oregonians go to Washington, and I know that we have Vancouver people who come to us. Typically, it's someone who works near my store,
right?
And so it's convenient for them to take out a loan from me.
Because Mr. Dewey says location is everything.
Yeah.
All right.
The gas is just going to get you with the price of gas.
Senator Wissett.
Chair Brzezinski, you put in that price. Approximately how many payday stores are there in Oregon, and about how many, on average, employees are there per store, and are these basically minimum wage jobs, or are they, can you give us some sense of that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I can give you the total number of stores in Oregon, which is approximately 365, I believe. As to employees per store, I'd have to yield the question to Ms. Stoltz.
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I would estimate that there are 3 to 4 employees per store, so that's probably in the neighborhood of 1,200 to 1,400 employees that work in the payday loan industry in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. And the other question was roughly pay scale, just in the ballpark?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, my employees start at about $9 an hour. And my highest paid employee makes about $40,000 a year.
Thank you.
All right. I'm not going to ask if there's any other questions. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. On the next panel, I'm going to ask Pam Levitt, please come up. And Marilyn Reed and Laurie McNew. And James Hunt. And Pam, I'm going to let you go first since you're in a neutral position and you can answer maybe some questions that Oh, and she has a soccer game. So very few questions from the
panel. At 5 o'clock in Tualatin. That's okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt, representing the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Our members did not take a position on Senate Bill 545, but we were asked to come and talk about what our members are doing in this area. The payday lending or short-term lending, microloan, are not new to credit unions. I just pulled this from 2000. This is a booklet our National Association talking to our members about the best practices for providing these short-term loans to our members and highlighted some of the credit unions around the country. So this is an issue that we talk about at our conferences and meetings, and it's been an important issue on getting these loans to members.
Ms. Levitt, I just want to make sure when we talk about members, what you're talking about is
credit union members. They are my credit unions.
Your credit unions, mm-hmm. Not actually the members of the credit union.
Correct.
So,
correct.
Okay.
And I provided you some written testimony. I also did a quick survey of the credit unions in Oregon providing these, and I gave you that data, and I'm just going to go over a couple points. The results of our survey showed that several of our members were offering these types of loans. As the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities testified, they did do a survey, and after that survey, they really saw that credit unions could fill an important role in providing these loans and had expressed via a letter to all of our Oregon State Chartered Credit Unions that they would like them to look at this area to provide these. When I talked to our members after this letter arrived, several of them responded, we have been offering short-term loan products to our members for years. We just don't call them payday loans, nor do we want to call them payday loans. However, many of our larger members did determine that they were going to roll out a new payday loan product, and the results of the survey kind of show you a variety of different things, and let me just kind of go over what they're providing. Most are offering the payday loan from, one of them was 2 weeks, but most of them were between 30 days and 90 days. The fees charged by the credit unions ranged from $10 to $15. The interest rates ranged from $8 to 18%, and federal credit unions are limited by federal law in charging more than 18% anyway. If you look throughout the survey, you can see that the terms, as I said, 14 days, 30 days, 90 days, some were 3 months, 6 months. The fees were varied all over the board from 8% to 10%, up to 18%. Many of our credit unions expressed that they encourage financial education to members using this type of product, and that's something that credit unions in Oregon are very interested in. We're involved in legislation here this year regarding financial education, but that was an important area for our folks using these products. But finally, our credit unions said that this has been a very successful program since they rolled it out. Under question 8, one respondent said we had 158 loans for $46,000 in 5 months with one small charge-off and very low delinquency. Most responded that it was a very popular program. The very last article from Julie Tripp from the Oregonian talked about a gentleman and First Tech Credit Union, and they said in just the short time they rolled out the program, they did 22 loans for $7,500 at 15% interest rate. So our members are trying to step up to the plate. We are providing these short-term lending products to our members and are certainly hoping that we can be an alternative to folks who want to use their credit union. We are surprised, and I've always been surprised, that the number of credit union members who have used payday lenders, and we always wondered internally why wouldn't they come to the credit union, and so we need to do a better job marketing the product and making sure that the members use it. So I will let you review the rest of my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It's not clear to me, would credit unions be covered by the restrictions in this? I'm looking for counsel for something.
No, we're not in Senate Bill 545 and have not taken a position. We just, because our products are not the same as what the payday lenders offer. The payday lenders do an NSF
check. And we don't do this. This is a short-term loan product.
It's a short-term loan product, but you've got the application fees, which an extension fee that would be kind of comparable to what I'm hearing the payday loan people charge.
And our loans can range, and theirs are, from what I understand, 10 to 15 per 100, and ours, the loan could be 300, 500. You know, it could be a larger amount. So those fees would be applicable to that amount.
Mm. Okay, because this seems pretty high as well. I mean, that with the fee combined with the interest rate, you know, seems very reasonable, but the fee itself would add the effective interest rate. That would be very, very high.
And these are, as I said, this is just a snapshot of our, Mr. Chair, Senator Burke, this is just a snapshot of our, you know, our membership and certainly not a summary of all of what they're doing.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Ms. Leavitt? She has to go to a soccer game.
Okay. Ms. Leavitt, when you said 15%, is that an annualized rate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, yes, it is.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, and let's see. Whoever is next, if you'll just identify yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Lori McNew. I'm here to tell you a story of what happened to my son, who is 22 years old. Last year, against everything I ever told him, he needed money. He went to a cash and go company called Cash Connection in Gresham, Oregon. He borrowed $1,000 for 10 months. The terms of the loan were $180 payments every month, $100 toward the principal and $80 toward the payment. That's an annual percentage rate of over 300%. Not only did my son not need the full $1,000, but as of this day, he has fallen behind in his payments because they are so high compared to his income. Maybe I watch too much TV, but this excessive interest rate seems like the terms of loan sharks. But this is a very real situation, and in Gresham, these cash-and-go places are showing up at every strip mall. When I found out about my son's loan, I called the state attorney general and a lawyer to find out what his rights were, and I was told there weren't any because there aren't any laws in Oregon that regulate this. I'm just an ordinary person. I have three children, a husband, a job, a mortgage, a loan on my car. When I've seen these stores coming up, I realized that they are easy cash places, and I assumed that the interest rates were higher than what would be charged at banks or at credit unions. But I never imagined that they'd be loans over 100, 200, and 300%. And I'm just here to ask that some regulation be put in to protect the consumers against these high interest rates. Thank you.
Thank you. Ma'am?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Marilyn Reed. I'm here representing St. Luke Lutheran Church, a church in southwest Portland, 1,300 members. We have a hunger poverty task force, and they asked me to come down and urge you to support Senate Bill 545. I will be very brief at your request.
I apologize. I know you said your name, but I was not listening close enough. I apologize. Could you?
Your apology is accepted. My name is Marilyn Reed, R-E-A-D.
Thank you, Mr. Reed.
Yes. Because you wanted us to be brief, and I'm certainly going to comply because I've also got a root canal that's gone bad on me, and I want to get out of here as fast as I can go. That's why I'm drinking all this water. What I did, so many people have covered what I wanted to talk about, and so I won't do that. I went to the Washington County telephone directory yesterday and looked up, and I think there are 13 or 14, I believe you have it there, of these organizations that are out in strip malls and everywhere else. And I thought that one of the things that might be interesting and of value is to talk about the marketing tactic that's used for people who are rather vulnerable to this lending. Urgent money, cash connection, any day's payday. I mean, I'm not putting anyone down, but that sort of appeals to somebody that says, you know, any day's payday. Cash and go, the cash store, fast money, high speed money, the loan marked. Paycheck Advance. These are marketing, I call this one that's in here a gimmick, because it says, se habla español. Well, many of the people that go there, ellos no hablan inglés, much less. So how can they fare? Oregon's most vulnerable people are attracted because of limited education, or they're desperate for money, for living expenses. And I want to reiterate that only Oregon and seven other states have no regulations regarding this group. I won't take any more time, because my letter that is written signed by the pastor of our church says it all, that the benefits of this legislation is fairness to the weakest members of our society. In his last sentence, he says things like the haves and the have-nots. I know that's divisive, but it seems appropriate. He said in the last sentence, we're only a strong society when our weakest members are protected and valued. And I believe that thoroughly. And that's why I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Hunt.
Thank you. My name is James Hunt. I'm from Silverton, Oregon. And I'm a member of the Social Justice Commission of the Catholic Parish of St. Paul in Silverton. This is a commission which is just one of many such in congregations of various denominations throughout the state of Oregon. Its mission is to serve the parish as a primary resource and catalyst for the work of social justice as inspired by the teachings of the church. And as such, it has educational, direct service, and advocacy components. In the matter before us today, in Senate Bill 545, the teaching of all religious traditions regarding usury needs to be fleshed out with a living reality of the human families involved, affected by such egregious forms of usury present today in the legal conditions providing for the so-called payday loans. Now, there are two levels of proper concern here, the first being for the poor families, the poor people themselves, and the second being for the welfare of the community as a whole, which, as Mrs. Reed brought out very beautifully, a community, a commonwealth, is only as good as it treats its most humble members. So this should be our concern. And we ask, how is it possible in this enlightened time and state of Oregon to bless with our laws an interest rate on a 14-day loan of, 350% to 700%, and of 182% on a 30-day loan? We know who these people are who seek these loans. They are low-income families who are confronted with an emergency situation requiring cash right now. We more affluent folks don't get into that kind of a position as a rule, because we have incomes sufficient to tide us over, or we have collateral sufficient to go for a different kind of loan. We don't live from hand to mouth, as these poor folks do. And they literally do live from hand to mouth. So, please, may we not at least lessen the worst of this vicious syndrome of interest gouging, and I use the term advisedly, because, dear folks, it is interest gouging. It shouldn't be called anything less. The interest levels proposed by Senate Bill 545, while still shocking to me at least, do at least take a somewhat less vulnerable portion or pound of flesh from these poor people. And it's therefore worthy of support. It's beyond comprehension to me that anyone can justly claim that the interest levels proposed in this bill are not high enough. I thank you very much for your kindness.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Thank you again for coming and testifying. The last panel I have scheduled, at least based on the information I have on the sheets, is Noreen Alplin and Gloria Colvin. And if there's anyone else that wanted to give testimony on this, these two bills, please raise your hand so we can go ahead. Ms. Gardner. We got 545, and we're also taking testimony on the 634. Those two bills are the other. That's one we got public testimony coming in now. Let's go ahead and let this panel speak, and then we'll make sure we've got everyone else that wanted to, because I want to go into the other bills that we have. Please.
My name is Noreen Goplin. I'm the director of Lutheran Advocacy Ministry of Oregon and a resident of Welch's, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity, Chair and members of the committee. Whenever representatives of the faith community become aware of community issues that place an undue burden on the poor, we're led by our response to Scripture, to the teachings of our denominations. And as people of faith, we respond not only to those, but we also respond to our own experience, our neighbors, people who come to us for help. And we know that everyone needs responsible lenders. The poor need credit, as do most Americans. Yet the vulnerability of the poor is what we're talking about as we take a look at placing some parameters on this industry. There's a place for responsible subprime loans, where somewhat higher interest rates balance the genuinely higher risk of lending to borrowers with past credit problems and marginal incomes. Clergy in the Lutheran community have become aware of the struggles. You heard one of our clergy speak earlier. As people of low income come to them for help, who have been entrapped by the processes of the payday loan industry. Desperate to escape a debt treadmill, rescuing people who didn't understand the terms of what they had signed up for, people who are not, is not a matter that they have a payday, but they're living on Social Security disability income, and it's not adequate for their needs. Many of these people have come to the position they're at because, as we've heard earlier, they're embarrassed by their situation. They don't want to reach out to their family. They think perhaps they can handle this temporary need that they're facing. We've listened to the community, we've heard and become aware of key issues with the loans. First, borrowers have little understanding of the amount of interest they were paying. And in fact, as we explored the problem and asked many people in our groups and friends and family to do a little math, we find most people have difficulty in projecting what particular rates would be. Second, when people need a loan to purchase groceries, to repair a car, to keep the utilities on, seldom are they able to stabilize their resources by the next payday. It takes too big a chunk out of their income. Most need a couple of paychecks in order to overcome their need for the loan, and yet the market design promoted by this industry is generally inflexible. Payment is due at the next payday. Partial installments on the debt are not accepted by most lenders. To meet their obligation, borrowers are pushed to take out another loan and thus to begin the debt trap that is so problematic for many.
No one suggests that this industry does not meet a public need for loans. Yet the practices are designed to obligate the borrower in terms and conditions that are often insurmountable. These are not the attributes of a responsible lender, and those conditions must be addressed. Senate Bill 545 is a reasonable response to the issue. First, in the limitation that is placed at 15 per 100, most important, in my view, is the extension to 31 days that allows a borrower the capacity to offset the costs and repayment of the loans, as they would be most likely having additional paycheck or more, and they have more of an opportunity to reorganize their financial obligations. The lowering of the debt principal and successive loans provides a mechanism to reduce the obligation. We commend these elements of Senate Bill 545. We also are really encouraged by the credit union industry in taking a look at this market so that perhaps we can have other options that are available in the community. But currently, we support the changes in 545 and see them as placing reasonable parameters within the industry so that the industry can operate and consumers are protected. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Committee, my name is Gloria Colvin. I'm the Executive Director at Fish Emergency Service in Portland, Oregon. And we've been serving the Portland area for about 38 years, and on average we serve around 1,800 to 1,900 people a month. 40% of those are children. We primarily give out food boxes, and that translates into 204,774 meals a year. We have four paid staff, and we usually have 100 to 150 volunteers, children to adults, each month. And last year, we had 1,112 volunteers that gave over 29,494 hours of service to the community. And we're here to testify in support of Senate Bill 545. And without repeating what the others said, one of the things I find is that many of the families we do serve are working. And often it's a combination of part-time jobs or low-wage jobs. And I was looking at this, listening to the woman talking about paying her employees $9 an hour. Well, if you have $9 or $8 an hour, but you have no benefits, medical or dental, and after you have taxes withheld from that, the reduction of what you have to spend to live can become very tight. And we find that most of the families are consuming 60 to 70% of their income on housing, rent, and utilities. And when they go to use the payday loan service, I don't think they're thinking about how much that is going to cost. And what they're panicking about is, I won't have a roof over my head. Where am I going to go? Or it's winter and my heat is going to be shut off or the light is shut off. And so out of that act of desperation to piece it together, they're going to do that. And in talking to them to hear their stories, and some of them filled out paperwork for us, they were very confused between both the fee and the interest rate. They would try to calculate that. They would mix it up. And one example I gave of you was a woman in her 50s who got a utility shutoff notice. And she borrowed $250 from the payday loan business. And she had to borrow the same $250 a second time, owing $212 in interest for $462 on a very limited income. That becomes an awful lot of money to pay, like everyone said before. And what it leaves them is unable to pay their other bills. So she didn't have enough money for rent, so she got a 30-day eviction notice. And as we talk about the common good, what I see happening here is people getting into trouble with the payday loans. Not everyone is $50,000 or $70,000 a year in income. In Oregon, we have a community of people across a breadth of income levels. And it seems to be those at the lower end that are getting hurt so badly by these. And not in a financial sense, but in a predatory, people sometimes call the loans predatory loans. And when I think of a predator, predators, when they hunt their prey, don't usually go after the most powerful animal they're looking at. They look at those that are weak, sick, old, or young to try to cull when they're hunting. And what we have in Oregon is significant numbers of people that are just struggling to get by. And the payday loans dig them in deeper and deeper. to desperation. And then on private charities like this, we receive no government funding. It's from the good graces of the community, churches, businesses. We have more and more people needing help, and at the same time, our community hurts because when they can't pay their bills to PGE or natural gas or to the landlord, he can't pay his bills. And I see that one of our goals is to try to support and strengthen the family and the community. And when you have people, every month, as soon as they pay their most basic living needs, begin to worry within 2 weeks, can I do it again next month? That stress on that family unit is severe, and often you see a breakup multiplying the problems. And it does become a community responsibility and often a public responsibility.
Well, then, thank you very much. Any questions for the panel?
All right, you can step back. Is there anyone else I should ask that wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 545 and 634? Let me tell you what I'm planning on doing. I've got a panel. I've got people here on another bill that have traveled from out of state. I'm going to recess that. I'm going to come back to that. I want to go ahead and allow the individuals that are here on SB 968, because I know they've traveled at some distance, to go forward. So I'm going to recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 545 and 634. And at this point, I'm going to open up a public hearing on 968. And for my committee, I understand that you may have other obligations if you need to leave. But what we're going to continue to do, I just feel obligated to go ahead and get the testimony in. We're not going to try to move anything out today, as I said earlier. And so stay if you like. If you can't, I understand. So, all right, opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 968. Representative Dingfelder, if you want to come on up and give your testimony, and then I'll figure out how we're going to do the next set.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be possible to bring up the other proponents, because I unfortunately have to leave right after this, and I'm.
All right. And who are those others?
That's Mr. Philip Wong.
Okay, Mr.
And
Wong.
Then Sybil Hepp.
Right.
And we're all speaking in support. And I really appreciate, first of all, holding over your hearing for this. And it is my husband's birthday, and I've arranged a birthday party for him. And if I am not there, I may be divorced after this. So I need to leave immediately. And I will say that the chair saved me from that fate. So, colleague, I can't say colleagues, but Senate Bill 968.
Sure you can.
Oh, here comes one. Colleagues. Thank you, Senator Beyer. For the record, my name is Jackie Dingfelder, State Representative for House District 45, and I appreciate you spending all this time on bills that I've been working on. Senate Bill 968, I've handed out my written testimony and also a fact sheet that I've put together. And this bill addresses refund anticipation loans. These are short-term, high-cost loans secured against a borrower's income tax refund. And I became aware of these within the past few years and have spent quite a bit of time looking into these, and it's been very interesting indeed, because instead of waiting to receive tax refunds from the Internal Revenue Service, refund anticipation loan customers borrow against their expected refund. So this is another form, in a way, of predatory lending. The typical loan term is 7 to 14 days, and this short term combined with high loan fees translates into an annual percentage rate of between 40 and 700%. These loans share many of the problems raised during the payday loan discussion, which you've just heard, and so I'll just hit on a few key points. These are high-priced short-term loans. As you can see in my testimony, I highlight some of the problems. The fees involved in obtaining a RAL, the refund anticipation loan, usually include the loan fee, the tax preparation fee, an electronic filing fee, and possibly other fees. RAL lenders often advertise lower APRs by unbundling the charges in order to make loans look less expensive. They usually only speed a taxpayer's access to refund money by a few days. And with electronic filing and direct deposit, the IRS says that taxpayers can receive the refund without a loan in as little as 10 days. So many consumers are misled and do not realize that the refund anticipation loan is a loan. They're often called rapid refunds, and I think that's a misnomer, and that's why we find that some consumers are misled into thinking that these loans are quick access to the refund. In a recent nationwide survey, two-thirds of raw consumers did not realize that they were actually paying for a loan. They tend to take advantage of low-income taxpayers. According to IRS data, 79% of families receiving RALs in 2003 had incomes of $35,000 or less. There is no registration requirement currently for RAL facilitators, so we can't enforce disclosure laws. These RALs also siphon money from the refunds of earned income tax credit recipients. That's your and my tax money that goes to help lower-income Oregonians offset basically poverty and having to go to food banks and do other things that we've heard here today. In 2001, 193 Oregon families received the earned income tax credit, and of those, nearly 25% received a refund anticipation loan. At a minimum, this amounts to nearly $1.3 million in fees paid for RALs by earned income tax credit recipients. Nationwide, and I think these are old statistics, because I just saw a new statistic which much higher, but over half of the RAL consumers are recipients of the earned income tax credit. And so that means that RAL siphoned off an estimated $740 million, that's taxpayer money, that went to loan fees. So what will this bill do? Senate Bill 968 will require full disclosure of loan terms so clients may make informed decisions about obtaining a refund anticipation loan. It would require loan facilitators to register with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This would allow the department to monitor the industry and enforce the disclosure laws governing it. And finally, this would bring Oregon's regulation of RALs in line with that of similar high-interest short-term consumer loans. And I urge you to support this bill. I do want to mention that I've had discussions with H&R Block, who are here today and will be speaking on this, and I unfortunately will have to leave. My staff will stay to answer any questions, who's been working on this with me. But I do want to say that I have been working with H&R Block. They have brought up several issues about this bill that we're willing to work on. We have some amendments drafted that I haven't even brought here today, but I just wanted to mention that there's several things in the bill that we're discussing, and I'm very interested and willing to work with them, and I appreciate them coming from Washington, D.C. here to testify on this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Wong, before you testify, I've got one other bill I need to take care of. All right. And I'm just going to shift gears just for a moment, make sure we got everyone on the same flight plan. As Senate Bill 935, understand I have one individual who's traveled over 100 miles to be here, and I'm going to leave that on for the night if that individual wants to testify tonight. The other people that are on the list appear to be here local or available at another time. So is it Art? Shanrod?
Turan. It's tough and I don't write very well. Thank you very much for sharing that. I appreciate that. I think, in all deference to yourself and your committee, I probably would rather testify on the bill when you're ready for it, when others are here to testify it as well, rather than take it out of order. I was just feeling as long as I might as well head on tonight or stay, but I think it would be better if I testified when the others are presenting testimony on the same bill.
Mr. Shanron, if that's your choice, if you want to do that, we'll be more than glad to accommodate that. We are going to reschedule it. But if you wanted to do it, I'll leave it open for you after we finish this set.
I very much appreciate that. I think I'll come back and testify when others, and you can set your attention more to that subject.
All right. So those that are here on Senate Bill 935, feel free to leave. We'll reschedule that, and it looks like that'll be next week. Or do we know? We'll let you know. We'll give at least a 48-hour notice, and you can check with Ms. Braun just to be sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I apologize for the time it's taken on the other two bills.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I just want to add one aspect to my testimony, is that I was just handed this information from Congresswoman Schakowsky. I want to make sure I'm saying it right, because there is a bill right now in Congress that is looking at regulating RALs. I don't know what the status is, but I just was handed this information, and so I'm hoping that we can get some information to you so you can see how this compares with the bill here today. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you're leaving, wish Tom a happy birthday and all that good stuff.
And I'm giving Philip a ride, so as soon as he's done, we will
then
leave. Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Wong, the pressure's on you.
I'll be very, very fast. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee for record, I'm Philip Kennedy Wong, represent Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, the State Association of Churches. You may have heard our board president earlier today, Reverend Dan Bryant, from First Christian Church. He could not stay, and so I'm here to represent EMO. We are in support of Senate Bill 968, and I just want to state briefly some of the features of it that we find very positive in terms of what we're trying to do, which is address the issue of growing poverty in the state of Oregon. Senate Bill 968, from our perspective, does provide a very reasonable disclosure requirements and modest oversight of the refund anticipation loan business. And what it attempts to do, and I'll just read directly from the bill, is that it prevents someone from knowingly taking advantage of a debtor or potential debtors' physical infirmity, ignorance, illiteracy, or inability to understand the contracts, documents, charges, or fees related to refund anticipation loan. Now, anyone who's ever taken a loan can appreciate that there's always a lot of paperwork, always a lot of small print that can easily skip by a person's attention. That's not to excuse their behavior for not reading those fine print, but it does mean that we have to have some sort of assurance that people aren't taken advantage of when they're in a situation where they do need to have a tax refund loan. What are some of the things that the bill does is quite simply, it's just good consumer protection, and that is to provide consumer education on the refund loan process, which includes disclosing what the fees are, what the interest rate is, and what the normal IRS refund process is if that consumer chooses to go through directly with the IRS versus going through a refund lending business. That's not to say that there isn't a need for that, but it's important that consumers have all the information they have that they can get in order to make the best financial decision in their best interest, of course. One of the things that Senate Bill 968 attempts to do, which we applaud greatly, is that it does attempt to ensure that consumers can realistically pay back the refund loan. And that's very similar to when, you do take out a loan, whether it's a line of credit or taking out a loan from a bank to purchase a home. There's usually an assessment of the ability of that consumer to be able to pay back that loan. And one of the features of this bill is that it does propose some examples of amounts of refunds in the schedules in which a person can repay back that loan in a certain period of time, so that allows and gives some assurance to that consumer what to expect before they engage into this contractual obligation. And finally, as mentioned by Representative Dingfelder, is the concern that we have on the impact to the Earned Income Tax Credit. As you know, the Earned Income Tax Credit was a proposal heralded by, and I quote, President Ronald Reagan, as the best anti-poverty, best pro-family, best job creation measure to come out of Congress. And what that means is that these are people who are eligible for the Earned Income Tax Credit who don't make enough money to get taxed based on their income, but they do earn some money, so they get some sort of credit to allow them to attain some of the basic necessities. Now, given the fact that a lot of these folks who are getting tax refund anticipation loans are eligible for the EITC, it does speak to the fact that there is a potential and risk of people being taken advantage of, especially when there are already low income, but needing that money quickly enough to be able to pay for some of the basic necessities they need to in order to live, not just for themselves, but for their families. So with that said, we do encourage you to support Senate Bill 968. And I would also like to mention a testimony that you have in front of you from an organization that we have worked with in the past, and that's the testimony is presented to you by Children First for Oregon. I do encourage you to read that and explore more in depth the impact it has on recipients of the EITC.
And Mr. Chair, if I may mention, and this has been submitted for the record because unfortunately Tina Kotek, the policy director, could not be here, an attachment to her testimony, which is very interesting, is by county showing how much each county receives federal EIC money, and then looking at, so you can get a sense then also of the number of, on the second page, federal returns, their value by legislative districts. So that just gives you a sense. If we're looking at 25% of people who are receiving an EITC are using refund anticipation loans, for each of your districts, you can sort of get an idea of who's actually receiving it. You should have received that attachment. Hopefully you do. And I found those statistics really very interesting. So again, thank you. I apologize for having to slip out. My staff will stay to answer any hard questions, and I'd be happy to meet also if you want to continue this at another hearing or work session.
Thank you. One other point of information. The other bill that we had scheduled for today, Senate Bill 573, based on the two individuals that are signed up, they are here local, and we have agreed to go ahead and take that one off. So if anyone else is here on 573, it will also be rescheduled. We're going to continue with the panel for Senate Bill 968 that we're taking public testimony on. I have one other person that's currently scheduled in the four column. That's Floyd Lanter. And then, no, that's neutral. So, Mr. Lanter, I'm going to have you wait for a second. I'll tell you what, once you come up, we'll let Ms. Hebb go ahead and get testimony. Because that way I can bring everyone else up at one time. So,
thank you, Chair Pozanski and members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb, and I'm the legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center. We're here today in support of Senate Bill 968. As you know, the Law Center is a civil legal assistance provider, and the people who are eligible for our services fall within generally 125% of the federal poverty level. So our clients are generally, for example, for a family of four, below an annual income of $24,000. This is exactly the population that is targeted by the refund anticipation loan industry, and so it's on behalf of this population that we're concerned. As others have mentioned, one of our concerns stems from the fact that we have seen the Earned Income Tax Credit Program be of great benefit to our clients. It has encouraged clients and low-income families to put money away in savings and to plan for big expenditures. It's also an incentive to work, and we have found it to be, our clients speak about it as though it is a great help to them in their lives. Unfortunately, the successes of that program are diminished by the proliferation of refund anticipation loans. Our concern about refund anticipation loans is threefold. One is, in effect, these loans entice low-income people to pay high prices for the privilege of borrowing their own money. As you've heard before, refund anticipation loans are really expensive, and they are very low risk. Remember that the security for a refund anticipation loan is a U.S. Treasury tax refund, and so there's a relatively low risk for the lender and a great expense for the borrower. And according to data that I found on the National Consumer Law website, there are interest rates which have reached as high as 1,800% when administrative and other fees are taken into account. So that exorbitant charge seems especially outrageous in light of the fact that they are relatively low-risk loans. The other concern that we have is that, again, they're marketed as a rapid refunds, and we think that's a strategy to take advantage of the fact that many taxpayers and many low-income families don't understand how quickly and how easily they can obtain their own refunds without paying any fees. I spoke with Jack Bogdansky, who's a tax professor at the Lewis and Clark Law School, and with Jan Pierce, who's a bankruptcy attorney at the Lewis and Clark Legal Clinic, and they both provided me with some information about the many places where low-income families can receive free tax help across Oregon. And I have 9 pages here of sites from Clackamas County to Yamhill County where free services are available to help people do electronic filing of their income taxes. And so if people were aware of that service, they would know that they could receive their refund relatively rapidly. And Mr. Pierce told me that just the other day he had a client who informed him that he'd received his refund within 5 days through a direct deposit into his bank account. And so that's a really rapid turnaround. So we're concerned that the this industry takes advantage of the fact that people aren't aware that that the system can work that easily. We're supportive of the safeguards that the bill provides and feel that they are reasonable and wouldn't interfere too greatly with the industry, but would provide some protections for consumers. We think it would make the bill would make it easier for consumers to make informed decisions so that they would be able to more easily identify whether or not and how they could repay the loans, thus helping them to avoid the cycle of borrowing money to pay back the money that you've borrowed. We've seen that escalating debt create great problems for our clients, and that escalating debt exacerbates other problems that they are facing related to child custody, housing, public benefits, and other issues that we help them with. So for those reasons, I urge your support of the bill, and I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Lanter.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter. I'm the administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. Thank you for allowing me to be here today to provide you some information regarding Senate Bill 968. As the sign-up sheet indicated, we are neutral with respect to the bill, and others have already testified as to the merits and some of the issues with refund anticipation loans, so I'll skip that and just provide you some additional background information. Currently, there's refund anticipation loan regulation in 5 states, 4 cities, 1 county, and pending legislation in 7 states. All 5 states require facilitators to make disclosures to potential borrowers about the amount of the fees, the time it takes to receive the loan, and the time it would take to receive a refund if the consumer does not apply for a loan. 4 of the states, Connecticut, Illinois, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, do not require facilitators to register. Only North Carolina provides for a registration element. Senate Bill 968 includes provisions to limit refund anticipation loan fees. It provides for mandatory disclosures accompanying refund anticipation loan applications. In addition, the bill contains registration and bonding requirements designed to ensure oversight and ensure compliance, and grants consumers a private right of action to recover damages, costs, and attorney's fees. This bill seeks to fully inform the consumer of what they're getting themselves into when they take out a refund anticipation loan. The department believes the most important elements of this bill for protection of Oregon consumers are the mandatory disclosures, the fee limits, the private rights of action. As noted, most other states have not included a registration element for refund anticipation loans. And we question whether this element adds significantly to the consumer protection provided by the bill. One of our goals in regulatory streamlining is to achieve consumer protection without creating unnecessary regulatory burdens. And with this in mind, the committee may wish to consider whether the registration requirement is needed. And I would point out, as an attachment to our testimony today, we provided a media release or news advisory that we issued to consumers in Oregon at the beginning of the year to alert them about some of the pitfalls about refund anticipation loans. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at your data and trying to compare it to the data from Representative Dingfelder, and specifically on the earned income tax credit. And her data says that in the year 2001, 193,000 Oregon families. Yours, let's say, 3-year period from 2000 to 2002, with roughly the same number. Can you help me to verify?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Beyer, I provided Representative Dingfelder the information, so we'll go with her number if there's a question. I can certainly research it. The information is from a study or a report done by the National Consumer Law Center and the Consumer Federation of America. And it showed using IRS data provided for tax years 2000 to 2002, in Oregon we had 192,600 families receive the earned income tax credit.
Could it be that she misinterpreted and she did her written testimony that were yours is a three-year time period, that she just assumed that the tax year 2000-2002 meant 2001?
Chair Przanski, Senator Beyer, I'll have to look at her testimony. I just heard it, but I don't have it in front of me, so I'll clarify that, get back to you.
Any other questions? All right, thank you both. All right, so I have, I'm going to go through four people that appears at this point. Jim Hintz, Bob Weinberger, Tom Eccles, and Matt Marquis. And it looks like Paul Cosgrove, Paul. Okay. So I think we can do it with four chairs based on if Matt's coming up. We got Jim, Bob, Tom, and Matt. Gentlemen, I apologize for the late hour. As you can see, we had a little more activity on the first two bills than maybe we anticipated.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing H&R Block. And in lieu of the time, I'm going to save all my comments. I do want to introduce Jim Hintz and Bob Weinberger from H&R Block, who have traveled some distance to be here today. So with that, I'll just turn it over to them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bob Weinberger, Vice President of Government Relations for H&R Block. I'm accompanied by Jim Hintz, who was a 28-year veteran of H&R Block and was responsible for the 137 offices we have in Oregon, where over 1,000 H&R Block associates prepare tax returns for about 163,000 Oregonians. We welcome your hearing, and we welcome the attention given to refund anticipation loans. We welcome full regulation of the product and assurance that consumers are being well protected when they consider this among many options. About 80% of H&R Block clients do not take a refund anticipation loan. But for those who do, it can often represent solving important problems and dealing with important needs. You've heard testimony earlier today, for example, about payday loans. Refund anticipation loan in Oregon costs, or the payday loan costs approximately 3 to 6 times what a refund anticipation loan costs. And many refund anticipation loan borrowers take the product to pay off payday loans because they view it as one solution to that problem. It's a product that can be taken only once a year, and it cannot, unlike a payday loan, be rolled over. For the people who want the product, there are a number of important reasons to consider why they might want to take it. For many Oregon consumers, a refund anticipation loan saves essentially 3 to 8 weeks over an IRS refund if they don't have a bank account. And about half of the people who use a refund anticipation loan do not have a bank account. For those who do have a bank account and can get their funds through direct deposit and electronic filing, it saves from 8 to 15 days, which is the time it takes the IRS to deposit refunds into an existing bank account. What happens to many people is that the winter is a particular perfect storm of financial difficulties. Around the time your W-2 is being received in your mailbox, which enables you to get a tax return filed, you're about to be overdue on holiday bills. And many consumers, as has been previously testified to, are living paycheck to paycheck, and the combination of medical bills, winter heating expenses, and especially holiday bills, seasonal unemployment, can combine to create a great deal of financial stress. The payday loan is one thing that people do in response to these problems, but the refund loan anticipates the fact that the average American taxpayer is getting a refund of about $2,100 and saving that period of 3 to 8 weeks if you don't have a bank account can be very critical. The primary use of a refund anticipation loan is to pay bills and in many cases late bills. The alternative may be late payment fees and damaged credit ratings. So many of the users of this product are facing a number of unattractive choices. The products are well regulated right now. There are 8 federal laws that we count and Internal Revenue Service rules that regulate either the lender, the loan, or the facilitator of a refund anticipation loan. And of course in Oregon, tax return preparers are also regulated by the state. The product has very high satisfaction scores from consumers, which is one reason we offer it. And it has the advantage to consumers of speed, convenience, and security. Speed, as I mentioned, the convenience factor is that the tax preparation and other fees are deducted from the loan, so a consumer does not have to have upfront money to get a return professionally prepared. And security is a factor also because at the beginning of February, when many refunds are received, very often those brown envelopes with a green insert received from the Treasury Department are insecure in some areas of cities especially. The final point I want to make is that many of the things that Representative Dingfelder's bill addresses are things, are disclosures that we are already making. At H&R Block, we consulted with a former head of the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection in developing our own disclosures and best practices, and also with consumer groups. And we believe we've come up with disclosures that make it very clear to consumers that they are getting a loan, that it is an expensive product. The IRS options are presented first so that people can understand what the no additional cost deposit from the IRS provides and what the time frame for it is before we get to any of the extra cost bank products. And we do this in essentially 5 layers. The first is a welcoming brochure to H&R Block that describes the experience the taxpayer is going to go through. And it has a page which presents the options for refund or balance due clients, including, again, the free IRS options before we get to any additional refund anticipation loan products which cost additional funds. Then when it becomes clear in the actual course of the tax preparation interview that the taxpayer has a refund coming and we have a discussion with them as to how they would like to receive their funds, if they express interest in a refund anticipation loan, we provide information that highlights the major features of the product, and on the back contains a chart which compares the cost of the various products, a timeline so that they can see what the alternatives are in terms of IRS delivery, and a sample transaction which shows how the what the amount of the refund is, the subtraction for tax preparation fees, the subtraction for a bank finance charge, and so on, and the final amount that they would receive, plus the annual percentage interest rate. That is a sort of generic disclosure, which, again, is pretty similar to what is in Representative Dingfelder's bill. In addition to that, on the computer screen that the taxpayer would see along with the tax return preparer, because the screen is between them and both of them can see it, we would provide for the individual consumer's own refund, the specific amount of that refund, what the option would be in terms of free delivery of a refund by the IRS plus the tax return fee that the taxpayer would have to come up with compared to the cost of the products, the bank products. So that would be a full disclosure which enables the consumer to see a side-by-side comparison of all the options, and this is a an important discussion that is had with the consumer. Now, you heard testimony that one study found that I can't remember the exact percentage, but many people didn't understand that they were getting a loan. This is a copy of the actual loan application. The loan application shows, I don't know how well it shows up on television, but these are bold letters, 2.5 inches high and 7.5 inches across. It's the word loan. And in the actual application itself, the word loan or refund anticipation loan or RAL, which is a defined term, are used over 100 times. So I think we've taken pains to ensure that people are well informed as to what the product is. The Truth in Lending Act requires that we fully disclose fees and costs, and that is done, our computer prints that out for taxpayers. In addition, we have an itemized fee chart which is shown to consumers, and they have full understanding by having that reviewed of what the cost of the transaction is. In the bank application, there is information provided that this is an expensive product and it may cost more than other sources of credit, and it encourages people to consider using other sources of credit. It also tells people that they can file their tax return electronically without obtaining a refund loan, that the IRS will send the funds in a certain amount of time, and so forth. And finally, at the end of the interview, one of the things we provide to our clients is information and various tips. For example, we advise people if they're eligible for children's health insurance in Oregon. We advise people whether they are eligible for food stamps. And in some states, we actually print out applications for food stamps. The same is true for other programs, Head Start, school lunch programs, Women, Infant, and Children Nutrition Programs. We provide for all clients who receive a refund anticipation loan advice on how next year they can plan to keep more of their refund if they do better planning that we are eager to work with them to do. We think in total that we've tried to offer this in a responsible and fair way, recognizing that consumers have a very strong demand for the product, but recognizing also that we want a full understanding of the terms, conditions, timelines, and alternatives so that people can make informed choices. And finally, let me say that since many of the people who take these loans do not have bank accounts, that we are working on a test in 7 cities with Bank of America to provide lower-cost bank accounts so that the refund comes on a debit card, which can avoid many of the fees which attach to a refund loan, as well as some of the high check cashing fees that people face when they walk either out of our office with a refund loan or receive a check from the IRS in the mail.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Hintz?
Well, I think I'm Jim Hintz, Chairman Przanski with H&R Block, and I'm from Gresham, Oregon. I'm really here to help answer any questions that you might have from a local perspective.
Okay. Mr. Eccles?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Tom Eccles, Regional Director of Government Relations for HSBC North America. I am here today representing HSBC Taxpayer Financial Services, a subsidiary of HSBC National Bank. We are H&R Block's national partner on refund anticipation loans, and we partner with some other tax preparers as well. I do not have prepared testimony for you today, Mr. Chair. I'm here to tell you that I want to offer my help to as you address this issue. I do have a leave behind of a media packet, which I have previously given to you, Mr. Chair, but I will give to the all the members of the committee.
Thank you.
Which provides information on explaining the product and explaining the steps that a customer would go through to get a refund anticipation loan. I would make a couple of comments that refund anticipation loans are driven by customer demand. Nearly 1 in 8 taxpayers gets some sort of a bank product, whether it's a RAL or another kind of bank product. 65% of our customers are return customers. And we strongly support clear disclosure through our business partners and through our own disclosures. 40% of our customers choose a product other than a loan, other than a RAL. And we offer our customers a 48-hour guarantee where they can come back in and cancel the loan, and we will refund their finance charge. And we offer free consumer financial education resources to customers as a part of the filing and application process. And again, I am here to help you as you address this issue. And I live in Olympia, Washington. I can be here anytime. So just please contact me if I can be of any assistance. And I'm here to answer questions.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Just one or two questions. In your written statement, I think you said it also, that I think the number was 70-some percent of your the customers don't have bank accounts, or some percentage?
About roughly 48% of refund loan clients do not have a checking account.
Okay. Where do those people go to cash their refund checks?
Variety of places. I'm not sure what the laws are in Oregon, but liquor stores may be able to do it. Check cashing stores. We have worked out arrangements at HR Block with recognizing that this is a problem for many clients. We have worked out some arrangements with. We attempted to get an arrangement with one national bank with the largest footprint across the country, and were not successful. But in Oregon, we have an arrangement with Wells Fargo, which will cash the refund anticipation loan checks for approximately $25, and with U.S. Bank for $10. These are specially negotiated for our customers. We don't receive anything for them, but we want to make sure that they have an opportunity to get an advantage rate in check cashing. At lunchtime today, I went into one local check cashing facility, and I was told that the check cashing cost would be 6%. And I think the national average for check cashing is about 3%. So we recognize that this is an issue for many consumers, and it's a problem we're trying to work on.
So, Mr. Chair, so if without the RAL check that you said that someone can go to U.S. Bank or Wells Fargo Bank for $10 or $25, a customer with a U.S. Treasury note or U.S. Treasury check, if they wait, get their refund check, is going to pay somewhere between 3 and 6% potentially to get that check cashed. So if it's I saw the number was $2,100 of 77% of taxpayers received refunds of $2,100 in 2004. 6% of $2,100 is that, I don't know, what's the math, $300?
It's less than that, but it's a lot. I think the example I used was $3,000, and I was quoted a check cashing fee of $180. That would compare to $10 or $25. That's a very significant difference.
And all, but included in that $10 or $25 would be the fees of about approximately $100 to get the. So, but it's still, in other words, it's still cheaper to
use. Even with the loan.
Yeah, that's my point.
Yes.
With the loan, it's still cheaper for that person to do that versus pay somewhere in 3 to 6% fee to get a check cash.
Right.
Thank you.
And yeah, and in fact, this may not be typical elsewhere in the country, I don't know, but at least in Oregon, essentially, the saved cost of check cashing may make this product somewhat more advantaged as against an IRS refund if you don't have a bank account.
Anything else? Is it?
I've got a couple of questions if I could. And I guess I want to follow up with what Senator Beyer is asking. If I came to one of your stores in Oregon, had you prepare my taxes, I say I want you to have the tax, have it mailed either to me or to back to the company store, and I'll pick it up there. Is there not any way that you would be able to actually cash or redeem the money that comes from that IRS check there at the store?
We're not allowed to cash IRS checks.
Okay.
In fact, they cannot
we cannot have the check mailed to us. I mean, it does need to go to the taxpayer.
Okay. I thought this morning we spoke a little bit, and I thought there were some arrangements that where people who may be more vulnerable to having their check.
The refund loan check is delivered to our office where it is delivered to the taxpayer, but under IRS rules, and this is a good example of where the IRS does regulate these situations, we're not allowed to cash IRS refund checks.
Okay, fair enough. Can you tell me about how much business H&R Block does in Oregon? And then, market share, I guess is what I'm asking.
Market share, I would only be speculating, so I would rather not say.
The reason I ask that question, because the next question I want to ask is, I'm wondering, based on what I'm seeing that you provide for your customers, as to, I guess, giving them the information for them to make their decisions, I'm wondering what, if any, other regulations, are there any regulations that require other companies to do this in Oregon? It sounds to me, from what I'm hearing and understanding, we have some regulations, but not a whole lot of regulations. And I'm just trying to figure out, is this a model that we might want to use in structuring whatever we may want to come out of this session with?
Well, there is extensive federal regulation. The father of all consumer protection in the finance area is the Truth in Lending Act, which does require full disclosure of fees and costs. In addition, all those who facilitate refund anticipation loans are electronic return originators, which are regulated by the Internal Revenue Service. They have to undergo an FBI background check, a tax filing check, a tax compliance check, a credit check, and annual suitability reviews. So the IRS does, and then it has rules in terms of what they can do. For example, an e-filer who is a tax return preparer cannot also be a lender. So H&R Block is not permitted to make refund anticipation loans. We can facilitate them, but the bank makes the loans, sets the terms and rates, and so forth. We are not allowed to describe a loan as a refund or a faster way of obtaining a refund. Again, some of the provisions in Representative Dingfelder's bill are already covered by federal law. Advertising is regulated, and we are also subject to various consumer protection laws that prohibit us from making false or misleading statements, and so forth. So I've given you a document, I think, which outlines 8 federal laws which cover these situations in much more detail than I'm indicating.
Okay, Mr. Weinberger, I'm going to ask you for your assistance. If you can't do it, I understand, but maybe someone with your organization. I'm wondering if you could take the bill, maybe point out for me what is actually covered under federal regulations and the cross comparison that you've talked about, some of the stuff that's already being provided for that would be required in the Dingfelder, let's call it the Dingfelder bill.
Okay.
At this point. The other question I had was, I guess the thing is, when we spoke earlier this morning, you gave me the impression that the way this is set up, and I'm looking at the settlement options screen that comes up, and it gives the IRS direct options and then the banking options with fees withheld. And my understanding is that you pretty much walk your clients through, and starting with, let's call it the least fee onus as to no fees at all, and what the procedure is, what they can anticipate. And that's the type of stuff I'm wondering if it happens for other businesses such as yourselves that are operating in the state. Do they have those same type of presentations for their customers? And I'm just curious as to what is out there, what isn't out there. I know that we have people here from DCBS, and so I'm assuming they're taking notes as well. But whatever assistance you can give this committee, that'd be very beneficial.
Happy to do it.
Any other questions? And then I guess the last question I have is, based on just the part of the bill that deals with notification and making sure individuals are informed, if we chose to actually put that in state statute, would you have a problem with that portion of the bill or those portions of the bill as it pertains to clearer, greater maybe information and disclosure to individuals?
I think our general preference is for uniform national standards because we're obviously dealing in all states. But we would be happy to work with you on disclosures for Oregon, which would meet your needs. We want to make sure they're workable and technically correct. We have had some measures in which elsewhere that we've been asked to make disclosures which are actually misleading or false, and we would like to avoid that, certainly.
Okay. Well, Mr. Weinberger, thank you very much for your travels. Safe travels back to D.C. Mr. Eccles, thank you again. I understand that you're willing to appear if necessary. And Mr. Hintz, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, that's all everyone I have scheduled on the witness registration for Senate Bill 968. I'm first going to ask if there's anyone else who wants to testify on 968. Not seeing anybody running up here to the table, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 968, and I'm going to go ahead and reopen our hearing that we currently have going on with Senate Bill 545 and 634. I believe we have two or three individuals who wanted to testify. Mr. Gardner, I have you down. Mr. Powell and Mr. Marquis are the ones that I have listed on the sheets. And Annette. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to first, and I'm going to be speaking solely about Senate Bill 634, so I would like to first turn it over, if I could, to I'm Jim Gardner, representing Cottonwood Financial. Turn it over to Annette Price.
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, for the record, my name is Annette Price. I represent the Community Financial Services Association of Oregon, and we are opposed to Senate Bill 634. Simply, in a submitted written testimony, we don't believe it's a necessary bill from the standpoint of we believe that the market forces should regulate the industry and that we have worked very well, we believe, with the department in finding and working with solutions to ensuring our industry is within operating within the regulations it currently has. So with that, I just will refer you to the written testimony. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gardner, did you have anything else?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, Jim Gardner representing Cottonwood. This is a more technical issue than what you were confronted with in the earlier bill, but it is an important one. And what I'm about to say in opposition to this bill, I want it to be understood in the context of constructive criticism of the department. We have the highest regard for the leadership of DCBS and their really even-handedness in terms of the policy review that they conducted of this industry. So this is all intended in the mode of constructive critique. I'm handing out to you first the administrative rule, which was adopted by the department to implement what is referred to as the good faith belief, good faith repayment belief requirement. And that I've highlighted the portion on page 2 of that excerpt from the administrative rule. And it basically says that that a payday loan cannot be made without a lender forming a good faith belief that the applicant has the ability to repay the loan, and that if you're in compliance with the stated criteria, you're deemed to be in compliance with that that provision. I've also given you a recap of the legislative history of Senate Bill 159, which was a bill considered last session in the area of payday loan regulation. And the thing that you will notice very clearly is that there was a proposed change to the statute, to 725.605, which would have applied the good faith belief requirement to payday loans. That was explicitly in the bill as introduced at the request of the department. That provision was deleted in the A. Engrossed bill. And the bill as passed by the legislature contained the deletion. So it was a proposal to do it pretty much exactly what Senate Bill 634 would do. That was taken out, and the bill was passed without out of the bill. In our view, and I did not write the legal opinion that was referred to. It was from the Bullivant Law Firm, but I've certainly seen it. In our view, that is a pretty clear indication that there was an intention to not apply that requirement on the payday side. And the folks who are going to talk after me will explain why that is, from a policy perspective, that makes good sense.
Mr. Chairman, John Palf, representing Cottonwood, again doing business in Oregon as the cash store. Mr. Chairman and Senator Beyer, the discussion has already taken place, at least in Corey Streisinger's testimony, about the questioning that one member asked her about the difference between a secured and unsecured loan. And it is true that secured loans, that good faith test, is usually applied for a very specific reason, and that is to prohibit lenders from intentionally lending at an amount in which they can then take the collateral, in the case of a title loan, for example, where you put your car up. There are other differences in the law that would also support the policy decision of having a different standard for payday loans than a secured loan. The number of rollovers, for example. It is more lax on title loans where there's security put up than it is on payday loans, which are unsecured. And it really is the lender's choice and the lender's desire to come up with what is a good faith amount that the borrower can indeed repay, because the loser, if the loan is not repaid, is the person loaning the money. And it takes at least five loans to make back the principal that you would lose on one $100 loan that's not paid back if you're charging even $20 per hundred. So the lender does not want to loan money and not be paid back. It takes the profit out of the business. At the same time, the lender understands that if somebody's car is broke down, as my window in my 2000 Chevy pickup was last week, and it costs you $400 to have it fixed, which it did, and you need that car to go back and forth to work, and in a normal year, this time of year, it's raining, and driving a car without a window is not only not a pleasant circumstance, but it will actually injure the rest of the car. So we understand that if a person needs that money, they're going to get it somehow. And I think it was Senator Beyer who asked the question earlier, nothing prevents somebody on an unsecured loan of getting another one. And that would be the eventual likely outcome of having a different standard or a lower standard for the amount of money that can be loaned. And that is, they would get a loan at one place for half the amount and go to another lender and get the rest. So I think there are good and logical policy reasons why there is a difference in the standard of good faith repayment between secured and unsecured loans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for staying late. Jim Marquis and my client is Community Loans of America. I'm having a bit of a dilemma today because I heard the testimony from the department, and I have several clients regulated by that department, and my experience with that department goes without saying is just
I believe that they're an outstanding department. I believe that they do an excellent job, in my view, head and shoulders above most state agencies that I deal with. And I also believe that Floyd and Corey are honorable people. And when they tell you that somebody told them they didn't need that provision and they asked to have it taken out because it was kind of duplicative in nature, I believe that happened. Still in awe, I didn't represent a payday lender last session, and I wasn't party to any of that. And when I took Community Loans of America on as a client, I did several things. And the first thing I did was go to the department and check with them about complaints and found out that my client had one complaint in over 5 years of doing business in Oregon. I felt that was pretty good. I spent 3 hours interviewing the client. I thought they did business the way they ought to do business in Oregon. And then I read the statutes and the rules. And when I got to this rule on payday lending and compared it to the statutory authority that the department has, it just jumped out at me. And I went over to the department and said, I don't think you got statutory authority for this. And I still believe that. So I think they did adopt a rule that they didn't have statutory authority for. I don't believe, my friend John Powell has covered the idea that this kind of good faith belief has never been applied in unsecured transactions to any lenders. I mean, it doesn't fit with unsecured loans. And so it doesn't make sense in theory. And you've got a department whom normally I admire coming to you saying we have a rule and we want you to conform the statute to our rule. And that's kind of the cart before the horse, I think. And that bothers me. More importantly, I think, and the piece of this that nobody has talked about is that their rule not only says good faith belief, but it says that, by the way, we'll give you this, we have this other thing here that says if your loan meets certain requirements, that is, if you lend no more than 25% of the consumer's monthly net income to an applicant that earns $60,000 a year or less, then you will be deemed to have met our requirement. And then it goes on and talks about other things. Well, if they can say 25% in a rule, they can say 5% in a rule. And I'm not sure that that is the kind of authority that should be left to rulemaking, because it speaks specifically to how somebody does business. And Section 2 of this bill grants the division authority with respect to payday loans to establish rules, including but not limited to establishing contract terms, charges, and fees. So 545, the bill you heard previously, would set out a 15% limit, and I think this bill would give the department authority to set a lower limit by rule. And I think that's excessive. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Only a statement.
Statement first, and I have questions.
I can't count the number of times this session we've been asked to codify a department, or not necessarily DCBS, but across the board. This is what we're doing by rule. We don't have the authority. We'd like to have the authority. And so, yes, it is putting the cart in front of the horse, but we see it day in and day out.
And Mr. Chair, even though that wasn't a question, I want to respond, because I don't think that DCBS normally finds itself in this position, and I don't think that they are normally the abuser that you would find of that process. I think in this case it's an unusual situation, because I think somebody told them they probably didn't need that, and I believe that may have happened. It wasn't me, and it wasn't anybody here. Could fault them for not challenging that at the time and saying, hey, wait a minute, where's our authority? And maybe that should have happened, but I think it's an unusual situation, and I don't think that it's an abuse.
Okay, I guess I'm going to, I don't know if this is going to be a question or not, but I want to take a few things in with a grain of salt based on, you know, we don't know what happened last session.
Exactly.
The reality, all of us that are sitting here aren't there. We've had representation as to what the department believes happened and why it happened. What I also know is that once whatever happened,
sure,
then we basically have someone challenging their authority to do stuff. I look at this, basically what we're trying to do, and I say we in the sense of what the department is looking at doing here, is basically incorporate unsecured into the same statutes that are already there in place for secure. And I guess the question is, you know, why the difference of standards for secure versus unsecured? And I'm not saying we're going to, come to an agreement today as to why that is good practice here but not good practice somewhere else. And I understand everyone's advocating for what they believe they need to for their clients, et cetera, et cetera. But I guess what I'm going to be looking at is exactly, you know, making sure that we have standards that are in place that give some protection as we think as a state that we want to have for citizens, not overbroad to the point of driving people out of business, but making sure individuals are fully informed before they enter into these type of contracts. And clearly, I believe there's two ways of doing it. We can put it in statute, very rigid. It's either in there or it's not. Or we have to give the ability and some flexibility, in this case to DCBS, to be able to have rulemaking authority where they can work with those interested parties in trying to accommodate whatever the needs might be. And so I guess the question I will leave for y'all, if you want to answer it now, great. If not, at some point in the future, is, I mean, what is the way to do this? I mean, should we put everything line by line, cross all the T's, dot all the I's in statute, or do we want some flexibility that when your clients find that there's something that's in statute that they cannot continue to work under, where it's in the rules, you actually have redress through that process to make certain that we can, in fact, keep businesses open and making sure that consumers have some protection in the areas that I think we all are wanting Oregon to be recognized for as compared to having a different, let's say, opinion of how maybe we address business as compared to some other state.
Mr. Chair, if I could just leave you with this thought. I represent a lot of financial clients and have for a number of years in this building. I've come to believe that the lending process is a process of decision-making between lenders and borrowers. A borrower chooses to borrow money based on a set of factors. The borrower first decides that he wants to borrow money and then chooses a lender. He approaches the lender and says, "Will you loan me the money?" The lender then has a decision to make if he will loan the money and under what conditions. The lender goes through a process. He gathers information about the borrower and makes a decision. And once he decides he will lend the money and under what conditions, then the borrower has a decision to make. Does he accept the conditions of the loan? That is a process that happens every day of the week, thousands of times. Every bill that you see that comes before you that attempts to regulate these activities with the kinds of restrictions that you're looking at today almost always is an attempt to replace the judgment of either the lender or the borrower with somebody else's judgment. To not allow the borrower to make the decision or to not allow the lender to make the decision, but to rather replace their decision-making process with somebody else's decision-making process because they know better. I know better. You can't borrow money at that high rate. Or you can't borrow money under those conditions. And you know, it would be nice if everybody was financially literate. Unfortunately, financial illiteracy is rampant in our country, and you and I have talked about that, Mr. Chair. And we ought to do something about that. But people are still entitled to make their own choices. And that's what I believe.
Mr. Gardner, did you want to say anything?
Well, in specific response to your question, which I think does get to the heart of the issue, is there a principal basis for distinguishing between secured and unsecured loans with regard to this particular requirement. That's the essence of the policy. And as my colleague John Powell mentioned, and Jim Marquis very eloquently said, there is a policy distinction, and the reason that you enacted the good faith requirement with regard to the secured transactions is because there was a fear that an unscrupulous lender might not give a whit about whether or not the loan could be repaid as long as they could get at the collateral. That's the rationale for that requirement, and it simply does not exist in the unsecured context. The only source of repayment is the borrower, the borrower's money. So by its very nature, the transaction prompts a determination, a good faith determination by the lender that he or she is likely to get repaid. Otherwise, why would you make the loan?
Okay. I guess I'll leave it. Mr. Powell, do you have anything else?
Mr. Chairman, that's kind of what I said, but not as well.
Okay. Well, I guess what I'd say is I think our position, and y'all, you've been in this process long enough, we as a legislature have a duty for setting public policy a standard, a threshold that we think is appropriate for conducting business and making sure there's at least some equal level. You know, I am not going to sit up here and I'm not going to be willing to see predatory lending. I'm not saying that's occurring, but that's something I think that we have all decided in this state that we do not want to see those who have such financial needs for whatever the crisis might be to be, let's say, overconsumed by being taken advantage of when they're in such a desperate state. I'm not saying that's happening, but I think that's a public policy that we in this state have already subscribed to, and we just need to just see whether or not we need to do anything else. And we don't have usury laws in this state, and I think there's has been a belief that lenders will, in fact, regulate themselves and work within a system. But what we do know, I mean, at least what I've heard from the testimony today, there is a market out there for people who need cash quick. It may be because of the economics we find our country in and this state in, and that people are just are literally trying to live paycheck to paycheck without being able to do that. So the reality is, I do believe that we as the legislature just need every once in a while to see where we're at, see if everything seems to be on the right track. And if it is, so be it. If it's not, then let's see what we can do in a way of tweaking, not gutting, but tweaking, and making whatever changes we might think is appropriate. And then we always come back and reevaluate that in the future. Thank you very much. Senator, anything else?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your courtesy.
Thank you, sir.
And we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 634 and 545. And do we have anything else for the committee?
Just before you turn off the mic, it's 628. We are still in committee. So those of you who are listening on the internet, I am still here.
All right. So covering for everyone, it is 627 and a half. It'll be 628 by the time we do the.
Yes. I received this testimony from Troy May, and she wanted me to hand it out.
So. All right, so there is one other piece of testimony that's going to be into the 545-634. If those who are here who want it, there may be extra copies in the back. We're closed the Senate Commerce Committee for tonight. Thank you.